Good morning, Council. We have a quorum, so I will call our Dallas City Council briefing meeting for Wednesday, January 2nd, 2019, to order. Happy New Year, and it is great to do the business of our citizens for another year in 2019. Welcome all. We will begin with our invocation, and then we will follow with our Pledge of Allegiance, led by our newest, oldest, experienced, been there before, Council Member Ms. Arnold. We are so happy to have Rabbi Andrew Paley of Temple Shalom in Mr. Kleinman's district. He is a great leader of this city, senior rabbi and spiritual leader of the temple since 2004, ordained at the Hebrew Union Jewish Institute of Religion in New York. He holds a master's degree in Hebrew letters from Ohio State University. He's a member of Central Conference of American Rabbis. He goes on and on. He serves on my Task Force on Poverty, Coordinating Committee of Faith Forward, Faith Leaders United for Peace and Justice, and is a chaplain in the Dallas Police Department. He has edited two prayer books, as well as authored numerous articles. He helped invocate at our memorial service for our fallen officers. Thank you so much for that important prayer. And he is married to Deborah Niederman, past president of the Reformed Jewish Educators, and a father of two children, Molly and Samuel. All rise.
Mayor Rawlings, members of our City Council, dear friends, being here with all of you again is always an honor, and I'm humbled to bring words of blessing to you as you begin this part of your terms. So we made it. It's 2019. The time for reminiscing and holiday breaks is clearly over. It's time to get back to work, and as the old saying goes, nothing changes if nothing changes. And what will our concerns be? How will we decide? Abraham Lincoln once said, "My concern is not whether God is on our side. My greatest concern is to be on God's side, for God is always right." And so in that spirit do we invoke your name, Almighty God, as we strive to come closer to you, to join you by your side and to make the changes necessary to create the kind of city and community worthy of your blessings. God of justice and mercy, we thank you for the gift of life and the opportunity to serve the people of our great city. Help our mayor, his staff, our city council and their staff, and all who work for the betterment of our city to act with character and conviction. Help them to listen with understanding and goodwill. Help them to speak with kindness and restraint. Always renew in them a spirit of service. Guide them to be the leaders your people need. Help them to see the humanity and the dignity of those who disagree with them, and to treat all persons, no matter how weak or poor, no matter their color or their creed or their station in life, with the reverence each of your unique creation deserves. And finally, O God, renew them with the strength of your presence and the joy of helping to build a community worthy of the human person. We ask this as your sons and your daughters, confident in your goodness and love. Amen.
Thank you, Rabbi, and thank you all for all you do for the city. Ms. Arnold is beginning her term with a special presentation, so I'll give you the microphone.
Good morning. It is indeed an honor to be back here with you again, and I know some folks said, thank you, Mayor, for those comments, being old and returned, but old and still able to roll. All right. So I thought it very appropriate today that we start out taking care of the business of District 4. And I have two individuals that I would like to bring to the attention of this council and also to the staff and to the city. And I'm going to ask those individuals to come and stand with me now, Mr. Derek Vati and Mr. Damon Fernandez, if you would come forward. He's here. You all can get here. We, in the course of us, me being on the council and just continuing to work in the community, I continue to be just amazed at those individuals who give of themselves and give of, them, of the time to District 4 and to this city. Mr. Derek Vati, if you would come up. Mr. Derek Vati, I met a few years ago while working in the community and was impressed with the fact that he was a serious constituent, a volunteer when it comes to the southern sector, but just don't say anything negative about South Oak Cliff because you're in for a fight. And so it's all about what can we do to help the kids, how we can prepare them, how can we protect them. He definitely not only advocates from an educational standpoint, but also is always there for the children that are victimized by violence. And so you'll get these texts throughout the night, bing, 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 what are we going to do? But I appreciate the fact that he does stand tall for these for the constituents. Now, he's been with South Oak Cliff almost 15 years, and he works endlessly, labor of love. He is here also with his wife, Mrs. Susie Vati, and she's also one of those warriors who continues to give of herself. So I want to make sure that I recognize both of them this morning, but just quickly, Mr. Vati is a graduate from South Oak Cliff, but I want you to also know he is a native, I'm not a native, but a graduate of DISD schools, a product of their schools. He also was an American and All-State basketball player and was part of the Texas URL State Championship for South Oak Cliff. What year was that?
1992.
And so whereas he continues to be a community leader in District 4, an educator, and a community liaison on the South Oak Cliff, I, Carolyn King Arnold, member for the City of Dallas, and on behalf of the Dallas City Council, do hereby extend special recognition to Mr. Derek Vati this day, Wednesday, January the 2nd, 2019, for doing more in District 4 and the City of Dallas.
Thank you. Good morning. Mayor, I told you about these little microphones last time I was here. On behalf of Dallas, Oak Cliff, District 4, District 3 as well, Mayor Pro Tem, that's where I grew up at. All of my friends around the council, Kevin, Tanel, Adam, and, of course, Mayor Mike Rollins and the other members of the staff, on behalf of South Oak Cliff alumni, we'd just like to say thank you for always respecting and honoring our community and continue to work with those that work in these communities every single day. Just want to say thank you to my wife, Susie, for allowing me to come out and play with you guys every now and again. Ladies and gentlemen, Happy New Year. Let's get to work about the people. Thank you.
Thanks. Go Bears.
Now, the next young man, I'm just so excited because this morning I get to tell him what to do, and I'm on the other side of the camera, so to speak. Come on up, Damon. I met Mr. Damon Fernandez during the course of being just working in the community and ultimately in the city council. And what was very impressive about Damon is that he always tackles his work with a smile. I don't know if I've ever seen him with a frown. And but what we appreciate about him is that he gives and continues to be dedicated to this community. He gives balance to news coverage. He always operates with high integrity. And so whether he's covering issues of homelessness, the need for senior citizen repairs, just whatever the interest of the background of the story, he handles with high integrity. And so it is with us, excuse me, today that we take time to say, Mr. Fernandez, being a senior member, a senior reporter at WFAA, a native of Baltimore, did I pronounce it correctly? Baltimore. He has made a tremendous impact on the southern sector and the city of Dallas and this community with his balanced and responsible journalism. Damon Fernandez continues to report issues on housing, economic development, civil rights, and community engagement, once again with a strong integrity. So I, Carolyn King Arnold, council member for the City of Dallas, on behalf of the City Council, do hereby extend this special recognition to Damon Journalist Fernandez for doing more in District 4. And so we thank you today, and we applaud you for your work. And don't take this lightly, because journalism and how we are perceived in this city by way of the news, by the cameras, is not taken lightly by us. And so when you give fair, adequate, balanced coverage, we definitely appreciate it. So thank you so very much, and hopefully one of these days soon we'll see you as lead anchor. Come on, you hear what I'm saying? I'm doing a campaign for him. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you so much, and Happy New Year, everyone. I bring you greetings on behalf of WFAA-TV as well. I'm one of those journalists who not only covers Southern Dallas, but I live in the area that I work. And with that comes a certain passion to make sure that we're doing the stories right and talking to folks who need to have voices heard. I've been here for about 4.5 years now, and one of the things that definitely rings true is that given the perceptions of Southern Dallas, which many times are unfortunate, I live in an area where people have a voice. People have some issues that they want to address. People have so many passions, magical passions, that need to be aired out on TV. It's my goal every day to try to get to the heart of those stories, try to get to the heart of the community that we serve, and to do it in a way that screams integrity. So thank you so very much for working with me. Thank you so very much for this recognition. I definitely appreciate it. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thank you. Thank you. What's that? Oh, yeah. Okay. Then, well, let's do a couple of comments. Mr. Felder wanted to say something. Mr. Atkins.
Yes, Mike. Happy New Year to everyone. My comments are to Mr. Petit. I think he's mistaken. I think he thinks that I'm his council member. I mean, I don't care what happens. It could be Oak Cliff, District 4, District 3. Most people around the horseshoe don't see or hear his comments and his pleas to me to resolve issues. But I think he'll tell you that I take care of everything that needs to be taken care of. So thank you. Good job.
First, let's get on the God of blessing to be here this year. Mr. Petit, you know, District 8, you know, we feed into South Oak Cliff, and I just want to thank you out of my heart that everything you have done and the Golden Bears have done, demands you always there in the Southern Dallas. Thank you, and just keep being there for us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take a bite.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Thank you. We'll see you soon.
Thank you. We'll take open microphone speakers, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, and good morning. This morning you'll have three registered speakers. They will be Sarah Lamb, Larry Johnson, and Ricky Gonzalez. I'll recite the speaker guidelines. Speakers must observe the same rules of propriety, decorum, and good conduct applicable to members of the City Council. Any speaker making personal, impertinent, profane, or slanderous remarks, or who becomes boisterous while addressing the City Council, shall be removed from the room. Individuals are given 3 minutes to speak. You'll notice the time at the monitor in front of you. When your time is up, please stop. Address your comments to Mayor Rawlins only. Also, if you have any handouts, go ahead and hand it to the officer to my right, as it will affect your speaking time. Your first speaker, Sarah Lamb.
Thank you so much, council members and Mayor Rawlins, for allowing me to speak today. My name is Sarah Lamb, and I live at 6519 Gaston Avenue. I'm here today to speak about the intersection of Garland, Grand, and Gaston Avenues, also known as the 3G intersection. Specifically, I would like to talk about the public process and ask formally why the City of Dallas is not taking a more active leadership role in the planning and approval of this project. TxDOT has held 5 public meetings and have refused to consider or present any plans other than Option 2 since December of 2016. This is 2 years, and despite enormous public outcry opposing Option 2, the public vote that occurred in 2016 was taken at a meeting that was only attended by 71 citizens, clearly not a true cross-section of the community or representative of the most impacted by the intersection design. Council members Clayton and Kingston have directed TxDOT to come up with a compromise plan, yet TxDOT has done nothing. And to date, the City of Dallas has not taken a leadership role in the process to ensure the final plan benefits all of its residents. In fact, the City of Dallas has failed to even follow their own process for a change of this magnitude. The thoroughfare plan shows that Gaston Avenue is designated as a community collector. Garland and Grand is also State Highway 78 and is designated as a principal arterial, 2 classifications higher than Gaston Avenue. The proposed intersection design violates the thoroughfare plan by redirecting Garland Road directly onto Gaston Avenue and therefore turning Gaston Avenue into a principal arterial. This type of change requires analysis by the Transportation Commission and must be voted on by City Council. This was not done. Hundreds attended TxDOT's November meeting and submitted written comments opposing the current plan. What will it require for us to be heard? Why are hundreds of citizens being ignored? Gaston is the only city street of the 3 streets. The city's only responsibility should be to Gaston Avenue. But so far, no studies have been performed to determine what this project will do to Gaston Avenue and the neighborhoods downstream. And no studies have been done to show what cutting off direct access to I-30 and South Dallas will do to these areas. It is overwhelmingly clear that Option 2 is not a community-preferred plan. The city must support a compromise plan that maintains a straight alignment of Garland Grand and operates within the thoroughfare plan. Thank you.
Larry Johnson.
Good morning, Council. My name is Larry Johnson, and I'm here to talk about the Oak Cliff Cultural Campus. Around 2.5 to 3 years ago, me and my sons were in the 10th Street Historic District cutting a lot that we had a contract on when we were approached by Patricia Cox and Sean Montgomery, who are lifelong residents of 10th Street. Ms. Cox further approached me and asked, "Son, do you know where you are?" My answer was, "Yes. I'm in a neighborhood where I used to deliver Meals on Wheels. I'm in Northeast Oak Cliff." She went on to tell me about 10th Street and exactly what is a Freedman's Town. She talked to me about my ancestors and my history, which is important to us. As the conversation went on, Ms. Cox talked to me about demolitions and the deck park, which is within a mile of 10th Street. It did not make any sense to let 10th Street go away when it could be a tourist attraction at little cost to the City of Dallas. Through several meetings with the 10th Street Residential Association, we decided to align ourselves with the deck park and other places around us, thus forming the Oak Cliff Cultural Campus. The Oak Cliff Cultural Campus is a community-driven vision for creating a cohesive, coherent, walkable urban quarter in Northeast Oak Cliff by identifying, preserving, strengthening, interpreting where required, and restoring the unique character of what is already there. The Oak Cliff Cultural Campus is anchored by existing and proposed cultural assets, including, but not limited to, the Dallas Zoo, Townview Magnet High School, the Bottoms, the Fleming Paper Mill, Moore Park, and the 10th Street Freedman's Town Restoration and Landmark District. Walkers and bicyclists can reach the Oak Cliff Cultural Campus from the east by the 10th Street Freedman's Town, formerly 8th and Corinth, and Dallas Zoo Dart Light Rail Stations, and the Santa Fe Trail. From the north, by the Trinity Levee and interurban trails. And from the west, by the Southern Gateway Park, spanning I-35, the 8th Street Bridge, and the 10th Street Welcome Center Pedestrian Underpass. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ricky Gonzalez? Not present. This concludes your open microphone meeting. Speakers for this meeting.
Thank you. We'll take up a voting agenda.
Thank you. Agenda item 1, approval of minutes of the December 5th, 2018 City Council meeting and the December 19th, 2018 special call City Council meeting. But I would like to make a correction to the December 19th, 2018 special call city meeting. Agenda item 1, under agenda item 1, it reads, it currently read Carolyn Arnold King instead of Carolyn King Arnold. So we're making that correction to the minutes.
With that change, I'll look for a motion. And a motion and a second. Any edits? Discussion? All in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried.
Agenda item 2 is consideration of appointments to boards and commissions. This morning, you only have individual appointments to the Citizen Homelessness Commission. Sam A. Merton is being nominated by Councilmember McGew. Mr. Merton meets the general public special qualification. And to the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Center Board, Clara Lee Brown Trimble is being nominated by Councilmember McGew.
Got a motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried.
Mr. Mayor, your briefings continue.
Good morning. We've got three briefings today. We'll see if we can get them all done in the morning. But if not, we'll take item C in the afternoon. Mr. Broadnecks, do you want to brief us, give us any prelude to the briefings?
Thank you, Mayor. As staff makes their way to the dais, we wanted to consider today the infrastructure improvement and discussion day, and staff is here to brief you on several items that they've worked on over the last several months, and obviously many of them have been to committees, but we wanted to share more broadly with the City Council as it relates to some improvements and clarifications, as well as areas of opportunity for transparency that we're trying to bring to many of our processes. So with that, I'll turn it over to Majid Al-Ghafri, Assistant City Manager.
Good morning, Honorable Mayor and Council Members. Happy New Year. I actually want to turn it over to Robert Perez, our Interim Director of Public Works, to introduce those three presentations.
We'll just take them one by one, and we'll discuss after each one. Thank you.
Good morning, Honorable Mayor and Council Members. My name is Robert Perez. I'm the Interim Director of Public Works. I have with me Ali Hatsifi, Senior Program Manager of Public Works, and Jennifer Nicewander, also Senior Program Manager of Public Works. This morning, we are going to brief you on three items. All of these items have been to MSIS Committee, and we have incorporated the comments from those committees into these presentations. The first one will be proposed revisions and code revisions and processes to right-of-way management. The presentation overview will include a background and history, purpose, implemented actions to point to this point, proposed actions and next steps. Construction in the city's right-of-way is governed by three main guides, one of them being Chapter 43 of the Dallas City Code, our pavement cut and repair standards manual, and the City of Dallas traffic barricade manual. Recently, City Council, we've heard a number of complaints or concerns that have come from City Council, and through this briefing, we intend to brief you on the items that we want to propose for revisions or code revisions in the coming future. There is a need to increase the oversight of construction in the city's right-of-way. There's a push to maintain accessible walkways or pedestrian detours during construction. We want to enhance the public notification process. We want to ensure more stringent restoration requirements for streets that have a high PCI or pavement condition index rating. And we also want to consider use of a contractor scoring matrix in the award of future work. There's also a need to accelerate the removal of traffic barricades upon project completion. want better coordination of work with other city departments, want to evaluate and recommend revised codes on steel plates, evaluate noise ordinance and waiver process, and enhance regulations to reduce utility strikes. Those three items that have the asterisks on them are all recommendations that came from the November 26th EMCIS committee. The first item, to address the concerns raised, staff has evaluated existing processing codes, ordinances, that govern construction within the city's right-of-way. The purpose of this briefing is to present and discuss the actions that we are going to propose for council consideration in the coming months. And the first item, increased oversight of construction in the right-of-way. So beginning on August 1st, we actually started issuing citations, not just violations, to contractors working within the right-of-way. Those citations carry with them a fine of up to $500 per incident per day. Between August 1st and November 30th, we've issued 137 of those citations. We started this process with four staff members, and by the end of this month, through consolidation of a couple of teams, we will have up to 11 people out there in the right-of-way issuing citations to the contractors. Those citations have ranged from everything from not having a permit on site to improper traffic control setup. The next concern that we've heard greatly of is maintaining accessible walkways or pedestrian detours during construction. The Dallas City Code today requires, as part of any traffic control plan, that sidewalk detours are required. To provide for an ADA access for anybody walking through or going through construction areas. The other thing that we're going to look at is for this is to evaluate the maximum duration of a permit. The permits are set for four months at a time. We're going to look to see if we can reduce that so that way we can free up some more right away as we move on. And just one other thing on that last one, my apologies. Temporary walkways or scaffolding, we're going to look at that as a requirement as we move forward. And that's something that was brought up in our previous EMCIS committee. Enhance the public notification process. So today, anytime we have work going on internally, we look to have a 48-hour notice. What we want to do to further enhance that is look at our codes to make revisions to where if a closure is going to be in place for less than 24 hours and there's no excavation, if work is going to be occurring at a location for 24 hours or less and there's no excavation, there's no lane closure, we won't require a permit. If there is going to be a closure or the work is going to last longer than 24 hours, we will require a permit. Those types of work, that type of work for the less than 24 hours include things like vault inspections, or if somebody's going in to do utility locates, they typically pull up, spray paint, and then they move off. So we're not going to require notification for that. If anything is in place longer than 24 hours, we'll require it. For work that's going to require a lane closure or it's going to last longer than 24 hours, we're going to require two separate notifications. We are currently writing into our contracts right now to require a 48-hour notice and a 10-day notice. So the residents will receive a 10-day notice before the work starts and then a separate 2-day notice before anything starts. And the construction on a thoroughfare or arterial street, a major street, will require two portable electronic message boards at least a week in advance of the work. For more stringent restoration requirements on our streets, today we have an age-based requirement for restoration on our streets. If a street is less than 5 years of age or less, today we currently require a contractor or whoever's working in the right-of-way to complete a micro or slurry seal on the entire block of the street or to replace an entire panel wherever they're cutting. What we want to do is go to more of a condition-based methodology in which if a street has a PCI or a pavement condition index rating of 75 or greater, they will be required to do the entire block of a slurry or micro seal or to replace entire panels. Next slide. Consider use of a contractor scoring matrix and bidder evaluations for solicitations of public projects. Right now, we're working with the city attorney's office to develop a matrix. You'll be provided a draft of that matrix at the end of this briefing for your review. That's going to consider things such as number of change orders, number of issues with residents or the public. We'll complete that at the end of each project, and we're working, as I mentioned, with the city attorney's office to look at alternative methods for using that information in bidding of future awards. We want to start looking at things like design build or competitive still proposals in which we can utilize that information as part of a best value in awarding of work. Accelerate the traffic barricade removal upon completion of projects. Basically what we want to do is add language to the code that basically gives contractors or whomever 24 hours to remove traffic control from a completed construction site. Failure to do so within those 24 hours will result in a citation. Coordinate work with other city departments. We actually recently consolidated the two groups that were issuing permits for work within the right-of-way. We're hoping that will better streamline our permit approval process. And then we also will talk about our five-year infrastructure management program. Essentially what that is listing out all of the maintenance projects that we're going to be completing over the next 5 years. We're providing that information, and each of your offices should have received a book that has all that information that we're sharing with other departments to ensure that we can coordinate our work efficiently. Evaluate and recommend revised codes on steel plates. We essentially want to add language to the code that basically makes it a citation, an offense that can be cited for any noise from vibrating of the steel plates. And then further to evaluate the noise ordinance, the waiver process. Right now the city code has from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. As far as work during, I guess, work hours for buildings. We want to move that over and use that as a guide for our approval process of work in the right-of-way. Obviously, this is going to be for planned work, non-emergency, for planned work, whereas emergency work will not be subject to this. And then enhance regulations to reduce utility strikes. There's been a number of concerns that have come up as far as utilities that have been hit. What we are doing and what we want to do, today we currently require that a right-of-way permit be on site. We also, as part of that, want to have the 811 dig test information on site as well. That will basically allow us to, that'll let us know immediately if the contractor has pulled or gotten their utility located. As far as our next steps, we want to engage with the private sector and utility companies. We want to have this discussion with them to let them know that these proposed changes are coming. We want to incorporate feedback from this briefing into our final recommendations that we will bring forward for council consideration in the coming months. With that, we'll open up to any questions.
Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem Thomas.
Thanks, Mayor. Happy New Year and good morning. I appreciate this briefing. I want to thank Robert and Magid. As you know, we had a major issue down off Redbird Lane recently where the streets almost were undrivable. So I want to thank you for addressing that. I received notification. Somebody sent me a message through Facebook, as a matter of fact, about and it was on a Saturday. We were having a holiday party, and the streets were really undrivable. And so I appreciate whatever was done and whatever communication you made with that contractor, because I actually drove through later that next day, and it was pretty bad. In regarding, let's look at page 5. And in here you talked about a notification. Maybe it was page 6. No, let's talk about the traffic barricade removal. If you tell me again, what's the current process? Because that's another issue that came up down in that area, that the barricade was there and it was almost impossible to drive, and there wasn't even notification whether you could, if it was a lane that was clear, you had a detour. So what's the current process on that, and what do you recommend?
So the current process, sir, is that we have an approved traffic control plan as part of each permit. Any deviation from that plan will result in a citation being issued. This is at the completion of a project. There's nothing that states that there's a timeline or anything like that for removal of traffic control at the end of a project. So we basically want to give a 24-hour. Anytime that somebody's advised that they need to remove something, they have 24 hours to do it. And this is the additional language to add to that.
Okay, page 10. And I think this is definitely something that needs some attention, some adjustments made to it. What is the current process? How do we notify residents of construction right away?
So in our guide or in our codes right now, it's a 48-hour notification, and that's what we write into all of our contracts, and that's what we require of everybody. There's a couple of providers such as Atmos. They actually have a two-step notification process, and we're kind of borrowing that from them. What we want to do, a 10-day and a 2-day before any work starts, and this is for major work.
Okay. Be a little bit more specific. How are they going about notifying the residents? What are they doing? Are they putting
door hangers? Door hangers. Yeah, and at any time that we're out there doing door hangers, if somebody's home, we'll knock on the door. We'll speak to whomever's there, we'll leave a door hanger if nobody's there. So that's what we do, and we do that typically 48 hours before. But what we want to start doing is doing the 10-day and a 2-day. So that's a two-step process and not just one at a time.
And how are you evaluating these contractors once they've completed the work to determine if we should continue considering them for work?
So you should have just been handing a scoring matrix. That was the document that was provided. Over the last several months, the Public Works team, along with DWU and a couple other departments, have been working with the city attorney's office to develop that matrix. Upon completion of our projects, we want to start completing those scoring matrices for each project that's done. And we'll basically continue over the next few months determining how we can use that in the award of future work.
Is there a way for residents in the area to be able to give you feedback in terms of if the contractor, felt like they gave sufficient notification, if barriers were removed within a timely manner? Is there a way in which they can give you, like a post survey, something of that nature? Is that something that we have in place, or something we can provide?
It's not today, but it's definitely something that we can look into.
I think that would be helpful. Imagine, Robert, you probably received an email from Darrell Baker, and he had offered some suggestions regarding that, and then also ADA, making sure that up front that's taken into consideration. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Question. When we do barricade on streets, when do we use, for safety reason, flashing lights, or we do not require flashing light? I have called many times my residents saying, hey, we are repairing a street, and there is no flashing light. And they say, we do not require flashing light for safety. And that's happened over the weekend. So when do you do that when we do not do that? When repair work?
So most work zones don't require that per the Texas.
It don't, but in some instances you do have flashing lights. Yes, you go down on Camp Wilson and 67, you did some work on the street, you had flashing lights. You go down Camp Wilson and 35, you were doing repair work, you did not have flashing lights, and residents say, hey, it was kind of unsafe because it's split. Do I go to the right or go to the left? And that was an issue. So I'm just asking that question. When that determined or not?
Council member, it really depends on the street classification, the speed of the street, and also the classification of the street, such as, thoroughfare, okay, or local street or collector, stuff like that.
Okay, so you said classification.
Right.
Is it 40 miles an hour street? Would that be a classification that you should have flashing light?
Well, I don't have it on the top of my head what are the exact criteria
for
the flasher.
Right.
But, in some incident, if it's close to the school zone, for example,
yes,
we may use that, again, on the major thoroughfare, We're going to use that along with the message board that we're going to utilize for any blockage or any closure. So it really depends on the situation.
Okay, depends on the situation, depends on what. Do you have a manual that said, when you do, can I get a copy of that?
Make sure definitely.
Because over the holidays, you know, we kept asking, no one could give us a proper response.
We can provide
the information.
Sure, we can provide the information.
For safety reasons.
Yes, sir.
The repairs of streets, when we do repairs, if we do a temporary repair, you know, asphalt, when do we come back and say that it's a temporary repair and then we do a permanent repair? So how do we address that in the timeline?
So each provider, whenever they pull a permit, each right-of-way user has a permit that's valid for about 4 months. It's valid for 4 months. And they have within that time to come back and do the final repair.
So if they do a cutting and they finish that today, then they do not have to come back and do the permit repair the 4 months later.
They don't have to, no.
Don't have to.
Yeah.
And
and that goes back to what we were talking about, evaluating the permit duration, that it might be beneficial to us to actually lessen that.
Well, the reason why I say that, sometimes you do a temporary repair, and next month it's rain, it's crack seal, you repair it again and again and again, and we spend a whole lot of time on that same pothole, and we probably spend double or triple amount of money to repair. We could have repaired within less than 4 months. So that's an issue. And when you look at the temporary repair throughout the whole district, you know, and you said, how do you notify the resident? Who in the department actually notify the resident? Who in the department actually go out and knock on the doors, and how many doors do you knock on, and how often, how does that guidance? I mean, how do you perform that, and how do you measure that?
So our contractors, if it's a contractor doing the work, they're the ones who are required to do the notification. If it's an in-house project, it's going to be our in-house staff doing that.
Okay. So how do we know that the contract didn't do the notification? Do they come back and say, we knock on 20 doors, or we Who police that?
So what we'll do is we'll do a sample of that. We'll go out and do a QC, probably about 10% of the work, just to make sure that we see those door hangers on those doors before the work starts.
Okay. So when you do that, I would love for you to come back to my district or come back to council and find and let me know how you do observe that, because in most cases, in some cases, you know, work they've done in my neighborhood that I've seen, I haven't seen any door hangers. You know, they do repair work. And when I do request, and people say, hey, I didn't know we're doing work on this particular street, so I need to have some feedback.
Okay. Not a problem.
Thank you. Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Mayor. One, I'm pleased to see we're making some changes in these areas, and look forward to actually, you know, looking at the ordinances when we put them in place. But I did have a question on page 11. You used to say streets that were 5 years, and now we're saying the 75 or higher. So what if the street conditions are poor and they're not good streets, and then, you know, we have utility work or cuts into them, and then they start degrading even quicker? So unfortunately, I don't have a lot of streets that are 75 ranked that high. So when they're working on bad streets, then they just become worse streets. So how are we going to try to mitigate that?
Right. So anytime that somebody goes and cuts a street, if it's, you know, older than 5 years, or as we propose here, 75 or lower.
And when you say older than 5 years, does that mean that hasn't been worked on in five years?
We accepted it within 5 years. And I'll give you an example. We were working on the south side of town. There was a development that started. They had brand new streets out there as part of the development. Unfortunately, the development didn't make it wasn't fully built out. So the streets were maybe 7-8 years old. We were fighting with a contractor because they wanted to cut into the streets that were pristine, because they weren't. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I respect that, but that's a pretty limited situation. We've got streets that are below ranked, below 75 throughout this entire city.
Right.
And we're having to have work done, and then we're seeing the degradation, you know, getting worse. So how are we going to try to alleviate that or mitigate that? Not on a brand new street, on an existing street.
Right. So, I'll tell you that any street that's older than 5 years, any street that's older than 5 years today is it might be in pretty, it might be still in good condition. This essentially is going to allow us, the street condition as it is today, if it's in poor condition, whenever they cut, they have to restore that area and any area that they affect while they're working in around that area. Other than that, we don't have, any other mechanism to address the rest of the condition of the rest of the block.
So, Councilwoman, if I may add, any repairs that have to be completed will have to match the street condition or better, regardless. What Robert is saying, to make sure that we preserve our really good streets, is
right.
Anytime that they would make any cuts, that the entire panels would be replaced or repaired, as well as a slurry seal is conducted for the entire block.
Okay. Which, I mean, I'm glad we're going to make sure our good streets aren't, you know, harmed any worse. But I'm concerned about, you know, what's considered replacing it back in the same condition it was found, or if it or better. I'm not finding that to be the practice followed. The work's done, the street's in bad shape, and then they just leave it in worse shape. And it's hard to determine, you know, when you got a bad street, how to get it back to just a bad street and not a worse street.
Right, which is typically when they go and they replace the trench that they've cut. And sometimes the trench is the best part of the street. So, that's we've seen that a lot.
Okay, and then on 12, when we're talking about changing, adding the scoring matrix, and these are for projects that are by the city, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
So then we would change, then on most construction projects right now we have a low bid process.
That's correct.
So now we'd be RFPing it out. Is that how I'm reading this?
Yes.
Because we would be incorporating an evaluation matrix.
Right. We want to use the evaluation as part of a best total value to the city. That would be one weighted component of that. So we would also look at things like proposed schedule, price, of course, and then the matrix. As part of that.
Okay, and so will you be taking that back? Is that an ordinance change, or how will that be implemented?
That would be part of the proposal, and when we come to council as part of the award, that's how it would be done.
Are we anticipating any budgetary impact from that? Like, you think we'll be spent? I mean, I'm going to be supportive of it. We're going to probably get a better product, but are we concerned that, you know, what we've budgeted going forward on the bond program or in this, you know, management plan, it's going to be impacted because we could be spending more.
We could be spending more, ma'am, but what we've consistently seen is our low bids tend to have a few more change orders, and what we're hoping to do is reduce that. And I think that when you take into account the change orders, we should be coming in fairly close to what our budget is.
Okay. Have you seen other municipalities utilize this?
Yes.
As well? Okay. Currently, the amount of time, the noise ordinances or the work, do we not have, what is in place now? This says 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. is when work can be done when it's adjacent to residential neighborhoods. What's the current ordinance?
So that's the current ordinance just has it specified for building, for works on buildings adjacent to residential areas. And so what we want to do is incorporate that same limitations on our right-of-way work as well. and what I guess one of the things that we have to balance is businesses, you know, working, or businesses that are next to residential areas. We have to balance how they may be impacted versus how the residents may be impacted. So it's kind of, we're trying to figure out what the sweet balance is, if you will. Because a lot of times businesses don't want to lose business during the day, but at the same time, we don't want to disrupt the the evenings of the residents. So what we're looking at is, and when we mention a case-by-case basis, is we probably, if we say it's like one night of work or something, we might ask the residents or the businesses to go speak to the residents and let them, you know, be aware of this. And if there's any major pushback, then we would have to basically ask the business to figure out something else.
Okay, but again, you'll, when it gets detailed how that's going to work, then you'll come back to us before we sign off on an ordinance.
Yes, ma'am. Because,
and then, you know, I've got a lot of Atmos work, and I know I've had some emails going back and forth with you all regarding, you know, their notification process and making sure things are put back in place. So the question I have is this compliance. And I hear from some of your answers that you're going to send inspectors out and make sure that there is compliance. Or are we just going to be reacting to complaints that we get?
Well, it's both, ma'am. Anytime we have concerns that come into any of your offices, we go out and look at that.
But just on a routine basis. When somebody pulls permits and cuts in our streets, are we going out and we're making sure that things are put back in place?
Yes,
currently.
As part of the project closeout, yes.
Okay, and that's through building inspection?
No, ma'am. That's through Ali and his team in Public Works.
So through Public Works and not through code either?
No.
But there is an over, like some of these would be code violations. Is that
we're
noise and things? Or you're going to do... monitor that through Public Works? Who's going to be the monitor?
We are in Public Works. So that's why we're adding this language to the code to make it any kind of noise violation, make it a citation that we can issue through us.
Okay. And then when we're the ones doing the work, are we're going to abide by all these new compliances as well?
Is
that the signage and
oh, yes.
Everything that we're going to be requiring.
We have an internal inspections group that monitors our work as well.
So who monitors our own work then?
Our public works team, a separate public works team, monitors our operations team.
So when we're doing the work ourselves, we come back and make sure that we're holding ourselves to the same accountability that we hold our contractors
yes.
to.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Grayson.
Thank you, Mayor. Let's go to page 8. Please talk to me a little more about that second bullet point. We're going to require temporary walkways or scaffolding when no active work underway on sidewalk. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so today you'll go out and you'll see a number of developments or work sites that have a gate or a fence all the way up to the curb line. Sidewalk is there, but they just have that area gated off or fenced off. For me, like looking at it, there's no active work there. That fence could very well be on the other side of the sidewalk to allow for access. If there is, and that's kind of what we're moving forward to, if there's active work in that sidewalk area, such as the sidewalk has been excavated, they're laying rebar, they're doing pouring, or they're doing utility work in that location, then, okay, we'll allow for pedestrian detour because there's work there. You can't really put people there. However, if there's no active work, we're going to require either the scaffolding or a temporary walkway.
I see what you're saying about if they, you know, they're not working on the sidewalk, then don't have it fenced off.
Correct.
But this says that if there's no active work underway on mm-hmm. the sidewalk,
right.
we're going to require a walkway or scaffolding.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I've got to think some more about that. For me, that doesn't make sense.
So if that sidewalk is blocked, Ms. Grayson, what we're saying, if that sidewalk is blocked and cannot be utilized because of that fencing, then a scaffolding has to be provided to the
residents.
You're
not going
to
require them to move the fencing on the other side of the sidewalk so people can use the sidewalk if they're not working on it. You're just going to require them to put in some sort of scaffolding?
We're requiring for them to maintain access through that site.
Well, okay. However that's worded, that makes sense. You just want to not have them be fencing things off unnecessarily.
Correct.
Okay, that makes sense.
And I also do want to point out the scaffolding. I know that's been a concern. Sometimes we can... you know, require the scaffolding, but if they're working on a facade of the building, then, I mean, it's, you know, a 20-story building, and we're afraid of things falling and, you know, crushing, then we'll use the detour for those types of instances.
Yeah, I know you explained in Mobility Committee kind of why you wouldn't always require scaffolding. As long as there's a way to get people around the site, the active site, then that's going to be acceptable.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, okay. So we're going to say that the time limits are 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., just like you do for construction on a construction site, you know, this closing streets off. But I'm thinking, for instance, of Harry Hines, you know, at the foot of the tollway where Harry Hines and the tollway come together in front of Pike Park. On a regular basis, they close lanes off there. It's like, who knows? You just show up that morning and there's a massive traffic jam and a massive backup. If you let them start doing that at 7 a.m., I thought there used to be something. There was one group that was working on a project there, and they didn't put the barricades up until 9 a.m.,
mm-hmm.
which was a really good idea because it allowed everybody going into downtown to work to get there before they started putting up the barricades. So if you say 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., you're going to have massive backups over there. I mean, for some reason, they work on that constantly. Don't you agree, Ms. Gates and Mr. Kleinman? I mean, the three of us are sitting there in that massive traffic jam all the time. So how do we address something like that, where you have a major entryway into downtown that's barricaded off in half the lanes? The last time, they barricaded off two lanes for two blocks, and one man was working there cleaning something out of the stormwater inlet.
So I can't speak specifically to that occurrence, but some of the things that we always encounter is sometimes a lane will be closed and somebody will say it was closed for no reason. And a lot of times we have concrete curing within those closures. So, I mean, that's something that we can't like constantly try to explain to the public. You know, it's closed because there's concrete curing. If you open it up before it fully cures, then the material will get damaged.
Yeah, but that clearly wasn't the case this time. So how do we monitor something like that? And if we say 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., they're going to be doing that on a regular basis because our rules allow them to do that.
But it is also different in the CBD and on major arterials, and that's why we look at it case-by-case basis. For those CBD projects or for the work on major arterials, we permit it to only allow between 9 a.m. and 3:30 p.m. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Do we currently do that, or are you saying why were all the lanes closed at 10 minutes to 9 and one man was working? So if we allow that, then you're saying that they violated our policies and you're going to go out there and give them a ticket?
We would, yes, ma'am.
And if we call that in, say we're sitting in traffic and we call that in, it's too late. There's already the massive traffic jam. And so you get out there and you give them a ticket the next day. Kind of what good does that do? So
it wouldn't be the next day. We would probably respond within 10 to 15 minutes. I mean, that's typically what our response time, anytime we have an issue such as those. We have people consistently sweeping through the downtown areas, uptown areas, major arterials. So, I mean, we get on those pretty quickly, and we get those resolved pretty fast.
So I didn't see that here in the briefing that says that the exception is that in the downtown area, it's 9 a.m. to what did you say? To
like 3:30.
To 3:30.
Yes, ma'am. It's not. That's what we do today. So it's not a change.
So it's not in here because it's not a revision.
That's correct.
Something that's okay.
That's correct.
I'm going to remember that.
Okay. We certainly, Ms. Grayson, we certainly can add that one. Not only that, but we're taking another measure, working with the transportation department into changing the time cycles of the traffic signals, especially on platooning, to make sure that the major thoroughfares have better coordination in between the traffic signals so we can move traffic a little bit better.
That's great.
And that's something that we've just started as well.
Good. That's great. Thank you. And my last question concerns the contractor evaluation form. There isn't anything on there about having the contractor remove the barricades timely. I know there's something about putting them up and that, but there's nothing on that form I saw that says that they were being evaluated for how timely they removed the barricades or kind of how thoughtfully they handled their barricades.
That's something we can certainly look into.
Yeah, would you please take a look at adding that? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Felder.
Good morning,
sir.
So a few of the questions that I have already been addressed.
My concern is the notifications where you're supposedly going door to door to put the hangers on the door. Do you do that for businesses?
Yes.
Okay. So one of the things that one of the areas that is the biggest issue in District 7 is Lamar Street. Serious issues over there. I drove this past weekend, and I was going south on Lamar underneath the SM Wright Freeway, and it said there was a detour, so I was supposed to turn. But I noticed a car in front of me went all the way up, so I'm trying to figure out how does something like that happen.
So your question is how does somebody ignore a detour?
No. Obviously, there was no detour because this car was able to go all the way through.
The only thing I can think of, Councilman, is that somebody adjusted the traffic control. I mean, without looking specifically into it.
So what I'd like to get some more information about is when you put out the notifications to homeowners as well as businesses as well as institutions. They're a major church over there. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but that project has been ongoing, and I think you and I have had a little communication about that. And we need to get a better handle on what's going on. I got a business that's flooding over there. So there's a combination of departments. I don't know how you're working with, I guess it's no longer Trinity Watershed, but it's now the Water Department.
Correct.
And we got a business that's flooding over there every time it rains. So we've got some serious problems that I need your assistance on, and I haven't gotten a firm timeline as to when this will be done. So I have a multitude of problems, but most of them center right there, because not only do I have Lamar, then we have TxDOT that's doing the SM Wright Freeway. So it's compounded. People over there are really being inconvenienced greatly, and so I'd like you to speak to me about that, please.
I'll have to get details on that and follow up with you, sir.
Please, as soon as possible.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Arnold.
Yes, thank you. Just want to piggyback on the comments that Councilman Thomas made about Redbird Lane. It was very interesting. It was a horrific experience. But in light of that, I'm glad to see that we're making some progress. Just two things. On slide 13, I just need to get clarification. Can you tell me a little bit about that citation? It says, what type of citation might this be?
So essentially, once we have, once the project is completed, if there's any kind of traffic control that's still out there, whether it be project signs or be barricades or anything like that, once we notify the user of that the need to be removed, if they don't do so within 24 hours, then we'll issue a citation for that.
All right, so, yes.
Ms. Arnold, the citation is monetary. It's $500 per incident per day. Up to $500.
Right. Is that for each violation?
Yes, ma'am.
I just want, okay. And the penalty is what? How much time are you giving them to pay?
Well, that's set by the court, ma'am. They have
so
to go to court for that.
They will be going to court, and
yes,
then they'll set that. Okay, that's interesting. We'll follow up on that. The other piece I know that deals with liability issues. I've heard from constituents from time to time that they have experienced some type of damage to their vehicles because of the present conditions that we experience as constituents. How does that work? Because if I damage, and I'll just take you back quickly to Redbird Lane where you had a entry coming on the off of Hampton to Redbird Lane, and you had a big drop. You can look at the shelving here, and you would drive over, and then the car would just drop. There was no flagging, no notification about the dip. So if I injured my car, damaged my car by any means because of that, what mechanisms or provisions are in place to protect our constituents?
So for any work that's done by a contractor, each of our contractors have to be insured, and essentially they have to file a claim with our contractor, and it gets reviewed and paid out by our contractor.
So can you walk me through that? Because I've had some constituents who fought, and they've got nowhere.
So
presently, how does it work?
So presently, the way it works is the citizen would contact the city. We actually have through our risk management group claims process. Because it could be either city work or it could be a contractor. If it's deemed city work, then the resident or whomever would be directed to the appropriate department, and the claim would be followed through that process. If it's a contractor, then it's basically routed to the department that's overseeing that work, and then that department works with the contractor and the resident to get the claim addressed.
So what would the resident have to, what would the driver have to show to you for proof to get there?
Pictures, pretty much pictures, and then estimates, or sometimes their bills that come to us, and then we go from there.
Is there a certain window of time that they have to file these claims? Because many of constituents don't know that they can do that.
I don't believe we have a time frame, ma'am.
All right. So if I have a constituent who have damage to his vehicle and can prove that it was because of this drop, or in this case, I think we had this kind of a manhole. It was just kind of sticking out on Illinois, because I addressed that. And they can show through bills, let's say that was almost 2 years ago. Can he still bring his documentation in?
If it was from 2 years ago, ma'am, I think it would be very difficult to try to, verify that. But, I mean, we can verify if there's a time limit for you. We can do that and get back to you.
Would you do that so that I
yes,
can
definitely.
Work a little bit better? Okay, thank you.
Is that it, Ms.?
Thank you, sir. I'm
sorry. Okay, good. Mr. McGue.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So I think I get most of the changes. I appreciate the briefing and the effort on this. My question really goes to slide 9 and really 10, and it all goes back to just communication with our community. And for a couple of years now, obviously not with you, but we've had the discussion about getting this information up on a website additionally. Where are we in that process?
So we do have all of our permits online, and the public can go view those.
That's not what I mean. Okay. I mean, when you drive by a project and you see it and it says whatever the project is, go to this website and look for it, and you can get, estimated timelines. You can get the information of what's happening, and it shouldn't be that hard for the contractors and or the city to get this information and to make it publicly available in a easily to understand way.
Okay, so we do have the bond website up right now that has all the projects. We actually have, as part of our IMP briefing, we're going to show you a map that we've already developed, and we're working with our CIS team to get that up as well. It's already breathing. We just have to put it online.
Yeah.
And in future workings, we want to get everybody's projects in there, not just public works. So when we get to the IMP, we actually have a screenshot
right.
of it.
And I knew I was maybe jumping a little ahead, but that's okay. That's really, it applies to this, it applies at every level of this. Inevitably, it's these issues where we got our community to start seeing something or start getting, having some degree of a hardship or something, and they just don't know where to get the information. And then it's actually sometimes difficult for us to get the information. Several calls and emails and waiting and finding, and it's just got to be as easily available as we possibly can. For all the projects, bond projects, amen. Thank you for that. But additionally, on these other projects as well.
We did recently revamp our project signs, and maybe it might be a good idea to actually put like the web address or something on there as part of that as well.
Absolutely. Okay. And, I'm not as technological savvy on that, but, I mean, it would seem that we could put whatever the project information is, and it usually has some degree of a number or a name or something, and just have that where when you go to that link, it goes straight to that project. You're not having to fish through certain block numbers on different alleys and whatever else that you see, whatever that project is. There's the information, and obviously these things are moving targets sometimes. So understand that, but an estimated timeline, any other unique components to that particular project, whether we're looking at different times or lights or whatever the issue is, we got it there, and it's available for the public to see.
Okay, sir.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Kleiman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. A couple of comments. On the evaluation form, in the section regarding safety and public service, item 12, did the contractor address public owner complaints? I think it would be helpful when we compile these forms if you actually attach all those complaints to the form. So if someone literally wanted to flip through and just look, it could be there just as an attachment. The other thing is I'm hoping that this while you printed this form out for us, I'm really hoping this is an electronic form that will be filled out online by our inspectors and maintained in a database so that it's easily searchable and people can evaluate it and do things like that.
It'll be online, yes.
Online,
yes,
and available, sir, to the public, part of our open data portal.
Yes, sir.
And readily available. I think that's important. And I think it's really important, especially if somebody's looking to run statistics, you know, how many boxes got checked, yes, no, whatever, across multiple forms. So think of it in that kind of a format where we're loading it into a database. The last thing I didn't see a lot of commentary on, but I think is critically important, is that we act as a coordinating effort between multiple both city entities as well as outside entities, because one of the concerns I have is, you know, repairing a street or resurfacing a street and then a street cut coming in, like, literally right behind it. I don't know why it seems like it happens a lot, but maybe it's just because visually I'm looking for it. But I really think it's important that when we do these notifications and post these out, that those third parties as well as internally, they're looking at those and maybe changing the timelines on their anticipated projects to match when work is being done on a street. I'm not quite sure how to do that. We can take either a carrot or a stick approach to it. I mean, the stick approach is to penalize somebody for doing a street cut on something that's been repaired within the last 6 months, or possibly increasing the right-of-way fee if they're cutting on a street that's been touched in the last couple of months. Or we could take the carrot approach, which is when we do these evaluations, if someone made an adjustment to their plan so they could work at the same time, maybe we throw them a couple extra points on the evaluation because they accommodated us. So I think when we do the evaluation form, we ought to look for opportunities to provide some carrot, like extra credit. You know, did they try to accommodate us? Okay, we're going to give you a couple extra points. Another example of that would be like if they want to remove, if they're really good about moving around the barricades, like Miss Grayson, you know, expressed concern about, yes, they're allowed to keep the barricades up during certain times, but if a contractor is really good about keeping them out of the way during rush hour and putting them back out, maybe they earn a couple extra points on the evaluation, that kind of a thing. So those are my major comments. I have one other, and I cannot read my writing. But nevertheless, do look for opportunities maybe that they can earn extra credit if they really treat us responsibly, especially if they proactively look for ways to lessen the impact of what they're doing. You know, maybe we can throw a couple extra points away. But thank you for this. It's much needed, and I think we're excited to do it. You know, Mr. Magoo's comments as well with regards to making it easy for our citizens to find the stuff and finding these evaluation forms. And you may consider, if you find these evaluation forms are successful, you may consider also doing an interim evaluation. Like when you do your inspections, if you're going to start attaching all these things to this database that's searchable, people kind of see along the way how they're doing as opposed to waiting till after the fact to see the final evaluation form. But overall, great. I mean, overall, this is what we want, is that responsiveness, that service level, that conscientiousness of we're serving our citizens. And things like street cuts and things like infrastructure changes and improvements, while in the end they serve our citizens, we got to be very conscientious of the impact it does to our citizens on a daily basis. So thank you, Robert and Majid and Ali and Jennifer, for the work y'all are doing on this. I think it's a very proactive and forward-thinking approach on how we're going to serve our citizens. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Second round, Mr. Felder.
Yes. So I think this is a positive step as well as far as the survey is concerned and the evaluation sheet. However, I want to go back to the signage that you have in the streets. do you have, like, the message signs, like, to give people an update? Let's say, for example, go back to Lamar Street. Let people know the estimated time on a flashing sign or a message sign, when they can expect the project to be finished, or which intersection is going to be closed, or, you know, things like that, information that people can read.
Sir, as part of the project sign, the estimated completion date is on there. That's the static sign that stays there. Anytime that we have major shifts of, like, transition of traffic and things like that, we'll put out a message board to say, hey, on this date, you know, traffic's going to be switched over to this side. And we typically do that maybe 3 to 5 days before that happens. But as far as, like, anything that's, you know, flashing or electronic, as far as, like, timelines or anything like that, we don't typically do that unless there's, like, some major change within the project.
Would you consider something like that?
Yeah, we can certainly look into that. Yes, sir.
Please, if you would, because, you know, again, we've got a compounded issue. We've got TxDOT doing something, and then we've got, you know, the city doing, so, you know, people are impacted doubly more than any other construction project. That's really all I had to say, and then, you know, I'll wait and get the information from you with regard to your door-to-door operation with businesses, institutions, as well as constituents. That's very important.
Understood.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Ms. Arnold.
Yes, on page, I'm looking now at the sheet, performance evaluation on page 5, on employment opportunities, point 15, on making a good faith effort to hire unemployed Dallas residents when hiring new employees, including the posting of signs. Will this include publication of information for hiring in the local newspapers, or have you considered that?
So the question is
Let me be specific. In some of our community, papers, what I'm getting from some of those publishers, especially the minorities communities, that we're not reaching out to them enough.
So Ms. Arnold, we are making a very concerted effort to work with Zarin Gracie and his team on the bond projects. As far as the public works project, that's something that we could follow suit and work with the larger projects accordingly.
All right, so I guess
That would include publications as well.
Right, so I just want to give this message, because it's been brought to me several times to my attention, is that we specifically start publishing in the papers, whether it's the Elite News, whether it's the Examiner, whether it's the Tribune, whether it's the North Dallas Gazette. This is a community-specific paper, and they're looking to be utilized more so that we can bring our people into the fold. And so I will continue to underscore that and appreciate your attention to that. Thank you, Mayor. That's it.
Thank you, and thank you for this briefing. Let's go to briefing B.
Next briefing is on the infrastructure management program. You also hear it being referred to as the IMP. I definitely have to give credit to Jennifer on this one. She certainly was the lead and provided great leadership in putting this together. The purpose of the briefing is to provide an overview of the FY 2019 through 2023 infrastructure management program, or the IMP. We'll review the city's pavement condition index ratings. We'll present program information on streets, sidewalks, and alleys, and then conclude with future actions. The City of Dallas has recently completed the development of its first five-year infrastructure management program. Essentially, it's going to list out all the streets, alleys, and sidewalks program for maintenance outside of the bond for the next 5 years. This program or this product will be utilized for program or project planning, budgeting, and coordination. And this speaks specifically to that coordination with other city departments as well as entities outside of the city. We've actually started sharing some of our information with ATMIS as well as with Encore, so that way we can start coordinating our projects better. And then, as I mentioned, we'll also provide the pavement condition assessment data by council district. Consistent with the city's goal of transparency, all of this information is currently on the Public Works website. The address is right there underneath the screenshot. It's under the pavement management page within Public Works. And there's a screenshot of the lists that are shown by program. So this is the working website that I mentioned. It's set to go live next month. We're working with our CAS group to upgrade a couple of items, but it should be out there. This basically mirrors our 2017 bond program's website. So as you go into each project, each area, you can list in a street, or you can, if you know the project name, you can put that in there as well. And it'll give you all the details that you're looking for, timeline, project manager. It'll actually have the project manager's contact information in it if they want to, you know, if whoever wants to contact them, they can speak to them directly. So we're going to start off with the streets, and then we'll also add the sidewalks and the alleys here in the coming months. All of that will be, so all of this, as far as the funding amount, will be subject to City Council approval. Right now, for FY 2019, everything is funded that you see, to include the $60 million for streets, the $2.2 million for sidewalks, and then the $1.6 million for the alleys. So for the IMP work, we have about $64 million work scheduled for FY 2019. The future years of streets are what we do have. It's our recurring budget in the street maintenance fund or in the street maintenance area. You'll see a difference from the 60.2 to the 50.8 between FY 2019 and 2020. That $10 million difference or so is roughly is attributed to one-time funds that we had in partnering projects with DWU. The sidewalks and the alleys for FY 20 on are not funded, and those would be subject to we'll basically be discussing those as part of our budget overview in the coming months. So over the next 5 years, we have about $531 million of street reconstruction and maintenance planned. 60.2 of that is going to be for maintenance and preservation projects in FY 2019. So for these 5 years, you'll see in FY 2023 for the bond, we have about $50 million programmed in there, and that's assuming that we pass a new bond in FY 2023.
So go ahead. So Mayor and Council members, as you see in the following slide, there's going to be a set of assumptions that staff has used for illustration purposes. What you see is the $50 million that staff made, again, assumption of to kind of complete the picture. But all of those are staff's assumptions without the approval of the City Council.
So in the last slide, you saw about $260 million or so programmed for bond work. Somebody may ask and say, hey, look, you know, we just passed $534 million for streets as part of the last bond. But we just want to point out that not all of that goes to, you know, street resurfacing or to reconstruction. There's other things in that $534 to include sidewalks, street lighting, alleys, and so forth that don't necessarily go straight to the streets. So we just wanted to show you that, you know, yes, there's $534 Prop A, but it doesn't all go to streets. So pavement condition index ratings. So as part of our pavement management strategy, each street segment is listed or has a PCI or pavement condition index rating of 0 to 100. A 0 is going to be a completely failed street, while 100 is going to be a brand new street. PCI data is obtained through field assessment and data modeling. We actually have a consultant that went out in FY 2016, did a full assessment of our inventory, and since then they've been doing a quarter of the street at a time. We're currently in our second run of the quarter streets being run by our consultant, and that's actually done through equipment that actually evaluates the pavement. It's not just, you know, somebody going out there looking at it with their eye. So street conditions have historically been reported through percent satisfaction, and what that was basically all the streets listed from A through C. That was your percent satisfaction. We have a current percent satisfaction of 77%. moving forward, we're going to start reporting on PCI, which is the payment condition index rating, and that basically takes the overall street inventory's condition and gives us a score. So for average, our PCI average for all of our miles of streets is 65.4. And you can see there that puts us right about a C. And all of our streets have a letter assigned to it, A through E, and that has the corresponding PCI next to it. So it was requested, and it's been requested, and we'll provide this each year as we update our information. This is the PCI, average PCI across the city by district. You can see it goes city district 1 through 14 and ranges from 58.2 up to 71.3 is the highest, 72.4 in district 12. So as far as our payment management strategy, we basically looked at three approaches. One is to maintain our current program repairs versus a best use model. We looked at a model that would achieve zero degradation, and we also looked at a model that what it would take to increase our PCO by 1 point over the next 10 years. So here, what you see on the top, the percent satisfaction in orange, basically the 77 goes down to the 63 over the next 5 years. What that says is basically a lot of our good streets are going to go from like a B to a C grade. And then if you look at the overall PCI of the 65, it goes down about 4 points over the next 5 years. This is based upon our current budget and looking at a best use of funds model. So we put this up here to illustrate that for every $1 that we invest in pavement preservation, basically in those higher streets, you're going to spend $20 for an overlay or resurfacing project and $92 for rehab or reconstruction project. So you can really see that you'll get the most return for investment on preventative maintenance work. The next slide here shows that corresponding to the previous slide, your slurry seal or microsurface, which is basically like preservation treatments, will go anywhere from $13,000 a lane mile up to a reconstruction of $1.2 million per lane mile. So you can really see if you catch the streets in good condition and you keep maintaining them, you know, we do get more mileage out of it for the same amount of money. So this is a zero degradation model based upon our current budget. So for FY 2019 and for FY 2020, we are maintaining zero degradation based upon our current funding levels. But beginning in FY 21, we would need a budget of about $201 million, and our projected budget at that time is 100.7. So beginning in FY 2021, we're looking at a deficit of about $94 million. And this is something that we're going to be working with the budget office, our CFO, and our city manager to evaluate in the coming budget processes.
And Mayor and council members, that still includes the assumed $50 million in 2023 for street work out of a bond program, out of a future bond program.
So to achieve a PCI of 70, this is basically to increase our PCI 1 point over the next 10 years. You can see beginning FY 2019, we're about $25 million short, where the budget needed is 132, and the budget that we have is 100.6 or 106.7. So we're looking at a deficit of about $26 million or so in order to increase our average PCI overall by 1 point. And you can see over the course of 10 years, we would need a budget, annual budget of about $248 million to achieve 1 point increase. So for the sidewalks, the IMP has $11 million programmed over the next 5 years. This year, we had a budget of $2.2 million. That was funded through our sidewalk assessment fund, which is it's been pretty much depleted. We use most of that funding to fund FY 2019. Any future years would need to be identified, funding would need to be identified to continue this program. The IMP, we're looking at smaller projects, things looking, we're looking to fill gaps and broken panels. These projects that are in the IMP were identified by the former City Safety Advisory Committee, our needs inventory and then sidewalk condition. We have about 5,000 miles of linear sidewalks that are next to our streets, and 670 of those miles, or 13.2% of those sidewalks, are in unsatisfactory condition. For the alleys, the proposed IMP includes $7.6 million for 544 alley projects over the next 5 years. The projects identified in the IMP would touch about 8.3% of the city's 1,400 miles of alleys. You can see in the chart that for FY 2019, the $1.6 million that is there for unimproved alleys was approved as part of the FY 2019 budget for our alley maintenance pilot. So the 1.6 will give us about 80 projects. The treatment for these unimproved alleys, these are going to be your dirt alleys, would basically be removal of 68 inches of the base material that is there, replacement and compaction of new base material, and then about 1 inch of rock. We did this in the Atmos emergency area earlier in the year, and so far those alleys have been performing pretty well. The ranking as far as the projects that are in here, one, they had to be gravel alley, two, they had to be sanitation alleys, and then three, they had to have a condition of a C or better, or a C, it was a C alley. The improved alley program, we would propose $2 million beginning FY 2020 to complete 16 miles of partial reconstruction of our improved alleys. So that's going to be mostly our concrete and our asphalt alleys. The rankings would be, again, that it's a sanitation alley, that it's an alley in C condition, and that the partial repairs would only make up 25% or less of the entire alley. So for future actions, we're going to continue working with our other sister departments to identify what programs or what maintenance projects they have programmed in the coming years. So we can incorporate all that information into our IMP, so that way we can ensure coordination. And then we also want to propose additional options to our pavement design manual to include asphalt street sections. With that, we'll open up to any questions you may have.
Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. First, I want to say thank you because and we got this in the Transportation Committee, some of the same information. How detailed specifically this information is, specifically by council district. You know, I don't brag around here very often, but I'm proud to say I'm number two when we talk about street conditions in our district. I think that it's critically important that we pay the necessary attention to those districts that stand in need of repairs of that particular nature. Let's look at slide one, or page one of the presentation. I mean, page two, I guess. Okay. I know Councilman Grayson will kind of follow me in this. Alleys. We definitely need to make sure, you know, in my district in particular, we have a lot of neighborhoods, and Councilman Moano can agree with that, because Troy and Oaks and Glen Oaks border each other, separated simply by Polk Street. We have a lot of older homes that have need of repairs in terms of alleys, and so we want to make sure, one, we have adequate funding, and then, two, that we have these in the pipeline. I'm continually using every form of communication, email, as we say, snail mail, social media, to let people know, hey, if you need repairs of your alley, you got to let us know so we can get on the needs inventory list. And so we can see if we have adequate funding. So we want to make sure there's definitely adequate funding for repairing those alleys. And then being able to prioritize those is critically important. I'm going to probably come back for a round two, but I wanted to emphasize that. And specifically having that information, Jeff, you did a great job, as we talked about in the committee meeting, of providing this five-year preview outlook for us to be able to see specific streets, specific alleys and things in our districts, and the time frame in which those repairs are going to take place. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Again, you know, alley is very important, just a sidewalk. Let's go to page 6. Okay, on this chart of 19, the year 19, are we saying that the $2.2 million of sidewalks already been spent?
No, sir. It's programmed, and we're actually moving out on those sidewalk projects. Okay. Council districts 1 through 6 should have gone out, or actually they've gone out already. Should be completed by March, I believe it's by March. The rest of the districts 7 through 14 will go out March through July.
Okay, you will give that to us when?
I believe it went out. It may have gone out on a memo, but we'll make sure, we'll verify that it did.
When it do go out, do you state how much money per sidewalk?
No, sir.
No, sir. So how is it forming the memo?
Well, no. We basically, I believe that the memo stated that we're moving out on the projects. I have to go back and verify, but I believe the memo stated that we're moving out on projects for council districts 1 through. It was a comprehensive memo that talked about not just these projects, but other sidewalk improvement projects that we're working on.
Is that the same as the alleys, the $1.6 million? That's the same memo, same type memo?
No, it will be. Right now, we're currently putting the specs together to bid it. But yes, once we have that. Put together, we'll send that out, that information.
Do you know when the timeline that you think that you might would be sending out the alleys memo, when we receive that memo for alleys?
The alleys are probably going
to... I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. The alleys are probably going to advertise for a bid within this month, and we'll come to council with the low bid for that.
Probably in March. Yeah, we'll probably come back to council in March, sir.
Okay. Page 8. This forecast for 2019 to 2023, if we look at sidewalks or street lighting, is this based on by district or citywide?
This is citywide, sir, and this is actually Prop A of the bond, the 2017 bond. It's a total bond.
Right.
And we only put this up here to show, in case somebody said, hey, you only have 200 and some odd thousand or million program for streets, and somebody might say, well, we have 534 in the bond, but we wanted to just show that, you know, there's other things in Prop A besides street work, which is why there's only 250 million.
Okay. Page 12. Explain the PCI rating.
So the PCI rating is basically an average of all of the PCI segments within each district. So you can, like, say for District 1, there's an average PCI of 61, and that's an average of all of the streets within District 1, the scores within District 1.
Okay. So if I go to percentage of satisfaction, who did the study? Is there a copy of the study? Are there a report that show you the percent of satisfaction?
Jen.
The percent satisfaction takes into account all of the streets that are in an A, B, and C condition and takes a percentage of that over the total. So we can get you that information, but I don't know that it's specifically laid out per district.
Well, it has to be laid out per district, because you got to come up with a percentage. I mean, did someone do the study? Was it outside? I mean, how did you come about?
It was done in house. The consultant that we have that did the PCI study for us, they gave us the data with the PCI, and then we figured out the percent satisfaction based on that data.
You said we figured out. Who is we?
Me.
Okay, can I get a copy of this study and find out how did we figure that out? So I know how you came up with that 80% for District 8, you know.
Sure. Yeah,
80% is pretty high, but I'm trying to find out how did you did it, you know.
Yeah.
I have a whole lot of streets in Cleveland Ride that don't even have streets, you know, and gutters and stuff like that. I need to see the information. I think it'd be great to get all the council members. How do you rise from those numbers?
Sure, I can get that for you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Kingston.
thank you, Mr. Mayor. Just as a general comment to you four, and you've been very generous with your time explaining your thinking to me and tracking down questions I had. So I really appreciate both the right-of-way management stuff and this pavement condition sort of strategic planning. I know that I asked you to do a lot more work, Ms. Nicewander, and you were very kind to have done it, so thank you. This slide is something that I think we discussed when you all came to see me in my office. Not all lane miles are the same. Those lane miles ought to have another column next to them showing total vehicle miles traveled. District 14 has 740 lane miles of road. It's the smallest geographic district in the city, but if you put vehicle miles traveled next to it, what we're going to see is that a huge proportion of the city's actual drivers are driving on streets that are much worse than the 90% satisfactory streets in Ms. Grayson's district, for instance. We've also discussed that we have six-lane divided arterials with dedicated turn pockets all over the city. A lot of the city was laid out in one-mile grids of these streets, and there are many parts of the city for which those streets do not carry anywhere near the level of traffic that they're designed for. And TxDOT will tell you a six-lane divided dedicated turn pocket street is essentially an infinite capacity street, like 80,000 cars a day, easy. We have those facilities in Dallas that do not carry 10,000 cars a day. And so when we're trying to – so the next few slides show us kind of the scare story, which is we don't have a way likely to be able to afford zero degradation, which is something this council is very interested in. We probably can't afford it. We need to be both looking on the revenue side, what we need to give to y'all to do your jobs in the way that we set policy for, but also we need to look at prioritizing which streets get fixed first. Because frankly, if there's a six-lane arterial or a four-lane arterial that's carrying 5,000 cars a day, I don't ever want it touched. Don't ever fix that street under any circumstances. That'd be an absolute waste of money. I always use the example of this little street in District 14 called Bremen, and the people who live on it aren't going to like to hear this. But the fact is, Bremen is a two-block street that is in deplorable condition. It's a D or whatever. And under what you have presented today, the likelihood of us ever fixing it is pretty low. I mean, it doesn't really carry any traffic. Almost everybody who lives on it has access to a side street, another street. So it's an interesting situation. So while all this stuff is excellent, and I know you're trying to get a big picture look at it so that we can see really how much we have to allocate to get ahead of this issue, and I'll be in favor, by the way, I think, of the best use of dollars scenario that you've described. But we need to have more robust data concerning what streets are truly the highest priority. And when I say highest priority, we have to not only consider the condition of the street, but how many cars it carries every day. I'm also very hopeful that we will, in the future, look at how the new traffic signals affect this strategic plan. Because if we're able to, by using modern signals, utilize the grid we have in a much better way, we may be changing traffic patterns in a way that we can't predict today. And we'll need to constantly monitor that vehicle miles traveled in order to see really where the priority needs to be. So let me ask you all, I don't remember you all having an answer to this when we talked about it earlier or at transportation. Is there a staff recommendation for what you would like to see us do with the budget in the next few years when we're in that $280 or $300 million hole that you show on the zero degradation chart? How would you all spend the money? How much money do you want, and how would you spend it?
That's a very good question, Councilman. I don't think the issue here is asking how much money we need. I think it's a combination of efforts. Do we need to invest more in our pavement conditioning? The question is, yes, we do. The point that you've made about the lane traveled miles is a very good point, and I think that's one of the priorities that we really need to establish. But another thing is that looking at other pavement methodologies or pavement material that could expand the investment would be very important. I've tasked Robert and his team to look at a couple of other material that could serve as well as concrete and could be installed faster and could be maintained a little bit better than that. That's something that staff is still a little bit apprehensive about, but they're probably going to try a couple of pilot programs. Asphalt rubber hot mix is a product that a lot of cities use and that has proven to be very, very reliable product. Other asphalt mixes are very good as well. So that's something that we need to approach. It's not just a financial piece, but we really need to approach how we practice here in the Public Works Department and how we marry all of the numbers, the metrics that we have, as well as the budget, to kind of really hone in on the true needs.
Well, let me say that in general, this team has my confidence. So far, what you've presented is appears to me to be highly credible. So I'll be looking forward to hearing your recommendations as we go in terms of the budgeting for this. But what I will warn you is, if there is a pavement condition of, you know, an average pavement condition drop off in the next few years, it's going to create problems for you and for us unless we can make credible promise that 7 years from now we're going to be back above where we were. So just keep that in mind as you're telling us what your recommendations are.
We'll do that, but a definite emphasis, Councilman, is on pavement preservation, because we want to catch the C and B and A streets and keep them in that condition rating, obviously, and then start, you know, eating a little bit at the conditions at D and E. And
I'm totally with you. It's just that your chart shows that unless we find $300 million, that dooms the D streets to falling apart.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Clayton.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Good morning. On how you do the ratings on the percent satisfaction. So I saw where you had the slide about A through C streets. So what is the cutoff on technically being a failed street? I think Mr. Atkins may have asked that question, but maybe not.
So there are different thoughts on what a failed street is. For us, it's D and E. And the D and E, I believe, is anything under the 55 range. Let me
slide 11, sir. It's on slide 11. It'll show you.
So D is where it's term failing.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Okay. The other question I had is on the PCI. I know when you came on board, we hired the consultant. We changed it. So what's different about how they go out and assess the street to how we used to do it? Because I remember, like, right when you first came on board, all of a sudden I went from being, like, one of the two worst, all of a sudden being a little better. And I remember being like, well, where did that come from? And it was like, hey, we changed the formula. So what's different in the formula of how we're assessing it now versus how we assessed it, say, 2 or 3 years ago?
So how we currently assess it is, again, in a bandwidth. It's A, B, C, D, E, and the C, for example, is anywhere from a pavement condition index of 55 to 69.9. That's all of it is satisfactory. How we're assessing it, we're peeling it a layer more. And what we're saying is that it's not just a C. It's a C, but it's this number, this specific number. So it doesn't fit in the just in the category of this bandwidth. It actually has a pavement condition number.
The PCI.
To it, the PCI.
And before we
before you
have
just
that.
Label it as part of a C condition.
So when we were going through the bond program and they're like, okay, pick your streets, and you know, you could see it's, you know, hadn't been touched for 25 years, it has a rating of 30.2 or, you know, whatever it had. So if I went back and looked at my, you know, spreadsheet of all the streets in the district and all the alleys, would it have a different number on that? So assuming they haven't been touched, obviously, would it have a different number today than what it had, say, even when we were doing the bond program?
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes, because, I mean, just based upon models, if we haven't, if we're just looking at the model, you're going to have some degradation, you know, over a year or two.
I'm sorry. Let me ask you in a different way. Okay, so again, in the 30.2 example, right? I thought when we came in, you know, we all of a sudden said, okay, the way we used to look at it was not right. Because I remember we had this conversation. You say, hey, now we're going to look at it in a different way. We have a different way of measuring this, because all of a sudden my streets jumped. You know, went from being the worst or second worst to, you know, jumped like four places, but we hadn't done any work. So in the new way that we don't take into account degradation, in the way we do the formula, would the numbers be different because of the way we do the formula? Does that make sense?
It makes sense, and it shouldn't be different.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I may want to visit with you afterwards.
Okay.
But thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Ms. Grayson.
Thank you, Mayor. Mr. Thomas was right. I'm going to say alleys, alleys, alleys. I don't think there's enough funding in there for alleys. And I know that's partly a function of the budget process in the future, but we just need to somehow make alleys a bigger priority and put more funding toward them. Let's go to page 8. My question has to do with your little footnote D, where you talk about a portion of the funds were used to develop this IMP. How much money was used to develop this program?
So, if I may say, so if you're looking at the resurfacing piece, all of that has been used as part of the model that we've developed for the street maintenance. So $145 million, the reconstruction, all of it has been used also for the pavement condition. So that's $108 million. About of the 55.2, about $12.5 million have been, I'm sorry, $13.3 million, that portion of the 55.2 has been also used for that model. And then $12.5 million of the $13.5 million of the petition projects that you see, street, alley, sidewalk petition, 12.5 has been used for that model to come up with $268.5 million that has been used specifically for the model of the street condition. $268.5 million.
To develop the information that we're hearing today?
No. This
no.
is.
I'm saying, what did the program cost? What to develop this IMP, infrastructure management program? That's what that says. Little footnote D says a portion of the funds were used to develop this program.
So if you look at slide, Madge's referring to slide 7.
Slide 7.
Mm-hmm. So of the bond money, of the bond funds, we assume $268.5 million, but that also assumes a new bond being passed in FY 2023.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Her question is, how much did we pay the consultant and or staff time
as
it relates to coming up with the PCI, not the projects that the PCI
touched?
Yeah,
not the projects that are part of it. How much did you spend to create this program?
So,
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Frugo is our consultant that that did the PCI evaluation, and we developed the program in-house. I'd have to...
The Fugro contract is what, about $230,000 a year?
It was a little bit more because initially we did the entire city.
Okay.
So I believe their contract was just at $2 million over a three-year period. And they, initially they did the entire city, and since then they've been developing the model for us and doing the PCI assessment every year since for about a quarter of the city.
So is that an allowed expense in a bond program?
That wasn't paid out of bond funds.
It wasn't paid. No. So the several million that you're paying the consultant over a period of years to develop this program didn't come out of bond dollars?
No.
Oh, okay, because that footnote looked like it did.
That footnote was just to say that the program, the dollars that were used in the modeling that we did for Fergro, that's where we took the dollars to model, so we knew how much we were going to spend every year to resurface or reconstruct the streets. That's what those dollars are for.
And we did develop the IMP in-house. We didn't hire a consultant for that.
Okay. Well, thank you for that distinction, because I didn't think that was really clear, at least not to me. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Manager, for helping me clarify that.
Thank you. Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Mayor. So to be clear, this IMP, so we're evaluating the streets totally different than we have in the past, right? So we can't compare past evaluations or ratings to what we have now.
We're presenting numbers differently, yes. A percent satisfaction versus a PCI, yes.
Right. And so in the past, I think we had I think it was reflected that council wanted to have achieve a satisfactory rate of 86%. Was that the number that I remember in the past? Or...
We'll verify. I don't recall that number. But
okay.
We'll
so
verify.
In your in discussions previously, we had this kind of laid out for us, and these are the conditions of the streets. This is how much money you need to be deploying to either have no degradation or to improve, and then we just I guess it's all out the window now, and it's hard to compare where we're at now compared to then, but. And they kept saying, should we change what we considered satisfactory? And I don't know why that decision was made. So you're asking us now to adopt, I guess, a satisfactory rating with this model as 75%. Is that correct?
I think more important is giving you the actual picture of our pavement condition rating. That's one. I think it's up to the city council to adopt whatever condition rating they desire. We are right now at 65.4.5. Right. If the city council desires that 70 pavement condition rating is the appropriate one, then that's the goal that we would shoot for. Obviously, staff wants to either keep the condition of the streets at or better than what we have right now. So that's
right.
One of the
so,
things
and,
that we're
and
looking
probably
at.
Probably if we had an artificial number that we're saying, we're probably not going to have the funds, because even at, we're not even totally funded just within two budgets, right, to stay at no degradation. And then all of a sudden it drops off. That's, mm-hmm. We don't predict having funding. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And then one, and we're not even funded to have any improvements in this budget. That I think, I don't know which pages those were, but so 65 is kind of what we're telling. Unless we're going to deploy a lot more money, we're not going to get any better than 65%. So I guess artificially saying to the citizens that we want 75%, we're not, and that's a budget decision how we're going to get there. So in with the consultant that's on board to give us this assessment, is it actually the street? I mean, in the past, we've been telling the residents that we go out there and actually drive the streets. Are we still doing that or not? I'm a little confused.
Our consultant drives the streets for us, and then we go out and we verify whenever we make the selections for the street, for the streets that are going to be included in IMP. We visually verify to make sure that it's appropriate.
So the consultant and the contractor is the one. We used to have a vehicle that we drove it,
correct?
But we don't have that anymore. Okay, so so all, a fourth of the streets are driven every year?
Yes.
With this contract, okay. And so it's actual, we're not just modeling something, we're predicting, we're actually driving the streets.
That's correct. Okay. And we did a baseline of the entire city, as Jenny mentioned, in FY 2016, and since we've been doing a quarter of the street, of the city at a time each year.
Okay, and then on some of the future considerations on page 28, we talk about asphalt. So is this, are you looking at, you know, repaving concrete streets with asphalt or doing is that what this is?
Either that
proposing?
Or in the case of reconstruction, we utilize asphalt instead of concrete.
You mean when things are, so you would.
So when you have rehabilitation, you have reconstruction, even some overlays, we will look into doing asphalt instead of concrete.
So when you replace it, then you replace it with asphalt, not concrete.
That's correct.
Because it's easier to maintain.
Much easier.
But so how when you, because sometimes we have reconstruction is just portions. So you'll have some streets then would be concrete, then it would change to asphalt.
That would be correct. Unless there is panels within a specific street, then they would stay for the integrity of the street. They will stay as concrete.
Okay. And I think this has been addressed in a couple different ways, but one of the things I'm concerned about, and I think Mr. Kingston mentioned it, I think Mr. Clayton mentioned it, was related to, and it's not real clear how you're going to prioritize the plan. I mean, are you looking at, what are the considerations that you're looking at? Not just condition, but you're going to be looking at how much their, you know, traffic counts, or what else are you going to be looking at? I mean, in the past we've talked about potential redevelopment, or we've talked about safety concerns. So how are we going to deploy the limited amount of money or are we just trying to get our numbers up? I mean, how are you going to prioritize the street? How's it going to get, you know?
So part of the PCI that they look at is the street condition, looking at the cracks and the severity there. There's another thing that goes into that is the rideability. So if a street's, you know, a lot rougher to ride, then that kind of plays into it too. So overall, the PCI kind of takes that into account. One of the things that we're looking to do with the best use of funds, I'm not sure if this exactly addresses your question, but prioritizing streets that are prioritizing preservation repairs versus rehabilitation repairs, just so we can use this and keep the streets that are in good condition for as long as possible. Right now, that's really kind of our focus.
So I think that's going to, the residents are going to have a hard time saying, well, my street is so bad and I see all the work happening on streets that look good. So we're going to be putting more money into maintenance is what you're saying. And those that, and then we just, the ones that are in the failed condition, you just wait for a bond program. So I don't see any new answers to how we've addressed streets with this.
I think we need to create a balancing act. I mean, I think that the focus point would be on preservation, making sure that at least the C, B, and A streets are maintained in that pavement condition index that we said we will do. But also, maybe programming some of the failed streets so we can, because that can bring up also the pavement condition rating. But to Mr. Kingston's point, I think the traveled lane miles is very important. The ADT, which is the traveled lane miles, is very important, engaging that places of congregation, schools, senior facilities, and others would be part of the consideration. A lot of people are traversing.
Moving forward, I'd like some more clarity regarding how they're going to be prioritized. And then second, as I wrap up, I just don't want to get so in the weeds that all we're worried about is a number and not an experience. It's like, oh, well, we've done this because we're looking at maintaining, so our rating's going up, but yet our, you know, everybody driving the streets in Dallas don't feel like there's been improvement made. So that's, I mean, I don't know how we gauge that, but, you know, faction of the drivers and in the when anybody using our modes of transportation, the sidewalks or whatever, or the alleys. So it's, I mean, and then I lastly, well, the budget. I think every time we have a budget process, we need to say this is what we're predicting now. This is how much money we're putting towards the streets, and this is what we're going to get degradation or we're not going to get degradation or whatever. So we make those budget decisions with full awareness.
You done, Ms. Gates? Okay, thank you. Mr. Felder.
I think you guys went over this, but I want to go over it again. Let's talk about, you're talking about the process of coming up with the PCI numbers, and I heard you mention modeling. So let's walk through the modeling again. So what percentage of the streets did you, or did the consultant actually drive?
So 100% in FY2016, and then it would have been a quarter of the city since. So we're basically working on the second quarter of the assessment.
Okay. So let's go to slide 12, please. So when you look at slide 12 and you go to District 7 and you say that there's 77% satisfaction and 66% average PCI. Let me ask this question. Did anyone go to Joppy? You did? Okay. And did you break that segment out? Because, okay, and what did you come up with Joppy?
I off the top of my head, I don't know, but I can certainly
I'd like to get that because, you know, 50% of Joppy doesn't even have any streets, sidewalks, curbs, gutters, or alleys. And so I'm very concerned about that. I want to make sure that those areas are not ignored. They've been ignored too long. There's parts of South Dallas that the sidewalks, you know, you can't ride a bike over it. You can't take a... disabled cannot ride their motor scooters over it, you know, the wheelchairs. So I'm concerned. I'd like to see some statistics. I'd like to see some breakdown because I think when I look at the 77% satisfaction rating, I've been living in District 7 for approaching 25 years. I wouldn't give it a 77%, not even in my own neighborhood. So I'd like to get some detailed information, your statistical modeling from 2016 to the present day. I need to know exactly how you got to this number because if I look at the alley behind my own home in my neighborhood, unsatisfactory. And so I've got to know where you went or where the consultant went and when they went there from 2016 up to today's date, because I would not give it a 77%. I'd like to know how you got there. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Grayson's already spoken. So, Mr. Kleiman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Just a couple of quick things on this. The assessments that we're doing, I think that this concept of vehicle miles traveled or some utilization is an important concept. I also think that it's really key, and this is my view, not necessarily the entire council's view, to focus on thoroughfare plan, arterial streets, and feeders, because I like to get the traffic off of residential streets. And one of the challenges we see a lot of times is that if a thoroughfare is in poor condition, then people start using the other residential streets. So certainly, and we talk about this in the bond program, in my district, let's focus on making sure those big six-laners are all good and clean and operating really well so people don't feel like they got to cut through residential neighborhoods. I know that's sometimes to the disappointment of some of my neighbors who live on very quiet streets and still would like their street replaced or repaired, but I'd rather just push the traffic out to the main streets that are designed to carry the traffic. And I have this similar view on alleys, which is I'd rather serve the front of the house than behind the house. And it's unfortunate that we have crummy alleys in a lot of my district and completely unimproved alleys in a lot of District 11 where there's not even concrete. And I think y'all are trying to address that in a different way. But I think primarily for traffic control as well as for traffic in the neighborhoods, maintaining those arterials, maintaining those items that are on the thoroughfare plan at their top level is important so that people don't feel the urge or need to go elsewhere. With regards to sidewalks, I always improving and always adding is important. I know we now in our permitting process for new construction, we're requiring sidewalks. We get a lot of folks that come in and ask for variances on that. I've kind of got a mixed feeling on that, but we do have to try to get those in as we can. In neighborhoods where you're getting teardowns and rebuilds and people say, why do I have to put a sidewalk in front of my house when the whole rest of the street doesn't have it? That's a concern, but in the end, we do need to try to build out as much of our sidewalks as possible. But overall, I'm glad to have a management program in place. I'm glad to have visibility into what's going on, and this is very refreshing just to know that we're working on it in a manner that we can really support the decision making process as opposed to just a small amount of at the whim of the council member, but primarily at the statistical level of where we need the work done. So thanks very much, Robert.
Thank you, Ms. McHugh.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So I'm going to take a little bit of the responsibility on myself, but in the line of what Mr. Clayton and Mr. Adkins and a couple others are asking, when I look at this presentation over the weekend and when I was seeing what there, it looks like there's been a lot of improvements in my district on streets versus what was before, but it hasn't happened in the actual improvements. And so just the way we're analyzing this is changing the numbers. I can tell before I was either second or third on the most streets with C and below. And so now I look at it, and the numbers are looking better, but I can't translate that to reality. So part of this may be just me. I need to understand, and maybe even in the presentation, we show specifically as best we can what a C street looks like, what a D street looks like, and kind of make this reality for us instead of just looking at it in the abstract of these numbers, because I'm just having trouble analyzing this and saying this reflects reality on what we're having. Now, I'm not challenging you on that. I'm just saying the numbers are different than what I have experienced in the past. And so I want to work on that. I want to understand that a little bit better. Ms. Gates' line of questioning and Mr. Kleiman as well, we also just need clarity. I don't know, leaving this briefing right now, if I'm going and talking to my community, I don't know if I can tell you, here's our priority, here's what we're going to do, and, you know, look, your street's not going to get it because it doesn't have this number of traffic on there or lane miles traveled per day or whatever it is. And so the more clarity we can get behind that, so we're speaking with one voice and being clear to our constituents, I think the more helpful it would be. And I'm just not there yet. And so I've got more work to do on this, and my ask is just that we continue to keep doing what you're doing. I think you're going along the right lines. I need help with understanding and being able to explain this in an effective way to the community.
And we can set up time with you, sir. We can definitely do that.
Okay, I appreciate it very much. I think that's it. Thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Grayson.
Thank you, Mayor. In response to one of Ms. Gates' questions, you talked about concrete streets being resurfaced or repaired with asphalt. I understand why you're saying that. It's a cost thing. But no. Concrete streets need to be fixed with concrete. And I've stressed that for years. And so far, my district arterials have been redone with concrete. That's what they need to be. Tell me why you think, besides the cost factor, that asphalt is preferable to redoing a concrete street with concrete.
The cost is one factor, but the timing of the repair, it takes about 3 months to set. To remove concrete and set the new panels and the traffic control plan that is involved in it. If there's any pavement cut, the concrete section is compromised because they have to saw cut it, and all of those seams become susceptible to lifting and issues with the subbase. All of that is part of the factor. So it's not just the cost, it's the ability to be able to move through the construction site, take care of, you know, take care of that, move on to the second site, and so on. So it's a timing issue, it's a repair issue, it's a cost issue. You know, 1 lane mile is $1.2 million for concrete. It's a fraction of that for pavement. And I'm not saying
it's also lesser quality. It's a lesser quality street. You're degrading the quality of our streets. Now, understand that if you make a cut in a concrete street and you have what you just described as kind of after that you have problems, that's also a degradation kind of issue. But no, concrete streets need to remain concrete. And so I very strongly disagree with that.
That's something that we could look at on a case by case.
I think you have to probably look at that during the budget process, but I just want to tell you that I just very strongly disagree with fixing concrete streets with asphalt.
Thank you. Mr. Kleinman.
I just had a question about Ms. Grayson's concerns about fixing versus resurfacing, because the driving condition and surface of asphalt versus concrete, do you have an opinion on that?
I think you get better rideability out of asphalt. Additionally, it's quieter. If you have a concrete street in a neighborhood versus an asphalt street, you're not going to get the constant, like, thudding, if you will, going over those panels.
Right. So I think if the underlying base is concrete and it's repaired as concrete, but still the surface can be asphalt, so we have a better driving experience, I think that's also a consideration worth considering. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me close this by just making a couple of comments. First of all, thank you for the precision that you've represented today, the sense of starting to see more reality in what is actually taking place, because this has been a foggy thing for us as a council for some time to understand. And so your work is much appreciated. I do believe we as a council have got to figure some things out on this. It comes back to your question, Ms. Gates, on prioritizing. I'm not sure it's staff's job to make some of these strategic decisions. I look at these ratings, and we all believe that we've got to do better. And we all believe we don't have enough money to do better. That's reality. This is why it's called work. And so we're going to have to power through this. What I'm concerned about is our practice in the past of looking at every council district as just divide everything up by 14 and everything must be the same. As we look at this city and wanting to grow Southern Dallas, it is the point has been made time and time again that infrastructure has not only need to get up to snuff, but probably lead Dallas as we try to drive economic development. So as we set agendas, Mr. Kleinman has made the point time and time again as well, we should have a picture of the MVA sitting up there every time we do this and say, how does this match up against the MVA? Mr. Kingston made the point in December that what we need in Southern Dallas is much more investment in infrastructure to drive economic development, and I agree with that. Getting to dive deep into District 4 while Ms. Arnold wasn't here, I saw the seriousness we've got, and it makes the point here in 62 and in Southeast Dallas and Pleasant Grove, 63. I mean, the worst. We're going to talk about this at our offsite on what equity means. And equity does not mean equality. It means investing in areas that we want to improve the fastest. So as we as a council, are we going to strategically invest or do what we've done in the past, which I think is very natural, and that is protect our voters and our council districts. That's what the council, I'm the only person that gets to kind of talk about the whole city as a whole. But it's, I pose the question, I've got my points of view on it, but it's more important that we as a council wrestle through that, and hopefully at the offsite we can do that. With that, we'll go into the next session. Thank you. Oh, Ms. Arnold, did you want to add something?
Yes, quickly. I wanted to ask, and then appreciate your comments, but alongside the fact that we do need to address these issues of the streets, and I'm in the process of requesting those reports, but the MVA in and of itself has been brought to my attention through our constituents that we need to do some work on that as it relates to the southern sector, particularly in District 4. So from the economic standpoint as well, I want to just make sure I mention that about the MVA. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Let's. If everybody's okay, I think we can power through this and get this third one done. Okay. Go ahead, Magic.
So the last update we have for you is deployment update on small cell network nodes. We presented this information to the MCIS committee on October 22nd. Presentation, overviews, background. We'll give you some background and history, operational impacts, and then next steps. So a small cell network node, what is it? It's essentially, think of it as a data or cell phone booster within pockets in between larger cell phone towers. They increase wireless coverage and network capacity, and they support both 4G and 5G deployments. The entities we currently have working within the city of Dallas include AT&T, Verizon, Crown Castle, Sprint, Extenet, and T-Mobile. So as far as some background, Texas State Senate Bill 1004 became effective September 1st, 2017. It essentially regulated Texas cities on the fees that we could charge to providers, timelines for review and approval of permits, and then also set restrictions on what we could require of the providers. So as a result of SB 1004, we developed a small cell design manual. Essentially, it talks about the processes for review, for installation, and invoicing for small cell equipment. We have a team that kind of spans several departments to include city attorney's office, public works, development, sustainable development, real estate, and planning. And the permitting process is also inclusive of Encore, as a number of the small cell sites are on the utility poles, at which point we require approval from Encore before we will approve any permit. So just to give you some numbers, so far, since November 30th, or as of November 30th of 2018, we've approved 551 small cell sites across the city of Dallas. There's a number of these, just to give you an idea, we're looking at about 1,000 sites for 4G deployment, and we're looking at about 10,000 sites to achieve 5G. So we're about halfway there for the 4G number that we anticipate. So a majority of the approved deployments to date have been on utility poles, 486 to be exact, and 65 standalone poles. That's actually a picture of one of the standalone poles that you can see out in the community. The initial approvals for standalone poles were per, which you'll see out there right now, is per our first edition of the design manual. That design actually had some challenge with the historic district, so the team had to work collectively to come up with a solution. So working with our transportation group, as well as some of the desires of the historic district, we designed a pole that basically encases all of the small cell equipment inside. It's a what we're calling a smart pole. It's an LED light that has capabilities of cameras or any other kind of IT solutions that we could incorporate into it. And all the, as I mentioned, all the equipment is down pretty much in the base of the pole. So on the left-hand side, you'll see what the pole looks like at one of the manufacturers. You'll see the base goes up to about 10 feet. It's anywhere from 14 to 18 inches wide. And then basically moving up, you have the light pole or the arm attached to it. The picture on the right actually shows one of the poles out. It's at San Jacinto, St. Paul. The beauty of this pole is that it can be designed to match pretty much anything that you see out there. So we're trying to match the poles that are out there. You can see on the picture on the right, the pole that was there before is on the left. So you can kind of see how it blends in with the environment in which it, you know, which is being deployed. So the operational impacts as far as the pilots, we're basically piloting that design that we just showed you. Most of the areas are going to be in the downtown and uptown area, and there's one, I believe it's in Councilmember Grayson's district. So we have moved forward with a pilot on arterial collector streets. One of the things that our design manual precludes or prohibits is deployment within residential areas or within 300 feet of a park. We had our first proposal come to us to go into a residential area. This is actually off of 4545 Cathedral. AT&T has proposed to replace the existing light, which is on the left, with a smart light on the right. In addition to street lights, we can also do pedestrian poles. The pole will be a little bit wider, but it'll basically match what's out there. As part of the approval process, what we're requiring of this is that they get approval of the neighborhood association and the specific resident in which the yard that they'll be deploying. So right now AT&T is working on that, and as soon as we get that information, we'll probably move forward with approval of the permit. Another pilot that we are working with the providers on is what we call micro trench. Essentially, it is a two-inch wide trench, probably anywhere from 4 to 12 inches down. They basically use a big saw to cut it, and they can complete about 500 feet per day. We think this is a good solution in that it's really fast. It doesn't really affect too many people, and they can do, like I said, about 500 feet per day. The next steps, we want to continue working with the small cell providers on the pilot programs. So basically, I think we put in three of the new poles already. We want to finalize the design, make sure that everybody's comfortable with it before we open it up as an option. We also want to work with transportation to put an emphasis on those smart poles citywide because they do carry the LED lights, and we do understand the importance of that light across the city. So we want to look to maybe incentivize some of the providers to go into areas that they normally wouldn't on their own. We also want to work with parks to potentially put those poles in the right-of-way of those parks. We think that the lights could light up the parking lots, and with the cameras, increase safety within those areas.
And, Mayor, in light of the statement that you made about equity in the southern sector, some of the pilot projects are specific to the southern sector that we're looking at, possibly with our RFPs with the different providers to see if there's any interest on that specific piece. And that would include lighting, that would include smart technology, traffic counts, other things that we could implement in there as well.
And then there's also potential federal legislation that might regulate, similar to what the state has done as far as SB 1004. We continue challenging both of those as well. We'll open up to any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Kleinman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and I won't belabor the topic about the way we're being treated by our carriers in the city. With regards to this, I very much appreciate y'all's attempts to mitigate this deployment of these pregnant poles across the city and that add to the visual clutter. I do think it's really important that we continue to push for equitable deployment of even 4G, which isn't fully deployed throughout our city, much less 5G. It's almost unfathomable that sometimes I try to talk to some of my colleagues on the phone in southern Dallas, and they just literally just get dropped signals because they just go through those areas that are in the city that don't even have voice capabilities, and that's just not right. So we want to continue pushing for that. I also want to take a quick look at slide 9, where you compared the two poles, assuming that if this is deployed, then the other pole will come down.
It's already down, sir.
Right down.
Yes, sir.
And the other thing, this is a good example of, in my view, it shows how our right-of-way is being taken advantage of, in that if that second, the older pole was actually on private property, for example, in a parking lot or on someone's private property, the carrier could very easily contract directly with the owner of that private property to put up a pole. But that's obviously a lot more expensive than just deploying it in our right-of-way and not really paying us compensation for that. So this whole argument about us really restricting their ability to deploy this is just BS, because there's a lot of examples, and I think I've seen some examples like along, I think we're some along Mockingbird, where there's like a car dealership, and you know there's a huge amount of lights on the dealership in the parking lot, and then we've got, you know, going to deploy a smart pole right in front of it, just more visual clutter. I don't know how to get around that and ask the carriers to deploy on private property when they can. It's just obviously cheaper and easier not to. So that's one of the things. I also want, I know a lot of council members don't know him, but Don Knight is here. He's our city attorney that works on these FCC and other regulatory measures. He is representing us in the FCC actually has an advisory committee in D.C. that meets quarterly, and he goes up there and represents us up there. Unfortunately, as much as we'd like to talk about this issue, the chairman of the FCC wants to talk about other issues like, you know, deploying healthcare over wireless and things like that. Nevertheless, he represents us well, and very much appreciate you being up there for us. Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Mr. Clayton.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Robert, thank you for visiting with me the other day about the one on Cathedral. So the one thing I didn't notice, when we had talked the other day, you said that they would match the poles that were in the neighborhoods. You know, I still have concern, you know, about one going in a residential area simply because it's a senior executive for AT&T. He has bad cell service. I think that's a really dangerous precedent to go down when we're making policy based on one person. But that pole is going to be wider than what the lights are now. Why? What is the rationale for having it wider? It looks like it's twice as wide.
It's to fit all of the equipment on the inside, sir. The meter, all of the radios, and so forth. That's why it has to be a little bit wider.
Okay. So in all of these smart pole pilots, so we know that, yeah, to Mr. Clement's point, that they went to the state, and they're making us pay for, you know, cutting into our streets because they don't pay us a fair rate. Do they have to pay for all these poles?
Yes.
Okay.
And a lot of times, sir, they'll turn them over to us to own. And because of that, we actually save on maintenance, that we don't have to pay to Encore any longer.
They turn them over to us. I don't get it. How do we save if we're maintaining the pole?
Okay, so right now we pay Encore if there is a light pole out there. And if they replace an Encore pole, we'll no longer have to pay Encore for that, and the provider will actually come back and put it back up if it gets knocked out, like down.
Okay, so basically we're basing it off the assumption that to get to 5G, which is what the providers want, that they're not paying us for correctly, that we're going to put in 10,000 more light poles in our city, correct?
It'll be a combination. Where we can utilize an existing Encore pole, a utility pole, we'll have them attached to that. If not, then they'll either replace an existing street light or put in a new pole or streetlight.
Can we mandate that? Because I think to Mr. Kleinman's point, which is the same concern I have about the private property, so if they can – their goal, and it's fine, it's what it is, their goal is to not have terrible cell service and so people can get on Instagram. You know, our goal is to protect our right-of-way, which we're having a hard time doing because of the state, and also making sure that we don't have a pole every 3 feet. So how do we, I guess I'm struggling with, how do we affect that? Because it's making base level assumption that we want to have 10,000 more lights in our city, which I don't know is a council directive.
Let me jump in there. Not all of those 10,000 that have been estimated will be on light poles. The 5G installations are smaller than the 4G installations. The small cells, these are even smaller, quote unquote. The small cells aren't all that small. But those 5G installations, because they were smaller, could go on existing Encore poles in alleys, things like that. So we wouldn't, I don't think anybody's envisioning 10,000 new poles as a result of that.
But if we have to maintain them, then we're maintaining all the lights and all that's our cost.
Well, if it's on a wooden Encore distribution pole, we're not maintaining
anything. No, but if they gift us these smart poles,
mm-hmm.
and then when they go to 6G, what happens to the poles?
Well, they belong to us, and they have street lights on them, and they may also have other smart devices, cameras, sensors, monitors. So we would be able to continue to use them even if they weren't using them. If we didn't need them anymore, then we could just simply remove them.
Got it. So, Robert, I didn't catch it the other day, so I just ask it now. You had mentioned, and I just lost track of what you were telling me on it, you were mentioning that you want to work with the Parks Department to put these in the parks. Is that an ask of the providers? I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, okay, we know that they force this down, you know, our throat by going to the state and lobbying against us. Why would we open Pandora's box and then allow them to go into our park system? I just don't understand why we would do that.
When we evaluated it, sir, it was more so for the safety aspects. If we can get a street light over a parking lot that, you know, susceptible to break-ins or any other kind of activity, we find that light mitigates safety or crime issues.
But if there was already an issue, wouldn't we have already have addressed it? So is this a solution that found a problem? Or I just think it's like, okay, we're already doing this, so let's go ahead and put it everywhere because they'll pay for the poll. And park seems like a natural thing to do. And I think it's going down a path because they've already shown us that if we voluntarily give them something, then they're just going to go to the state and mandate we do it anyway. And I'm just concerned that parks is the one thing we can kind of protect that we can keep natural. And once they're already going to do 10,000 of these, of course they would want to go into our parks. And I'm just concerned that we're not protecting our parks a little better, I guess is my concern.
Understand. It's not something that we have to do, obviously. If the decision is made that that's not where we want to go, then we won't go there.
Has it gone in front of the park board?
No, it's not gone in front of the park board yet. We have been working with parks to develop a design that they would be acceptable of.
I would just maybe ask that before we already, I'm not being critical of you, don't misunderstand me, before we already come up with the solution, let's ask the park board and then the council if we actually want to do that. And if we do, I don't want to do it, but I'm only one person, so I think that would be just an appropriate way to go about it. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Mr. Atkins.
Thank you. Go to page, I think it's page 10. Okay. The location of the smart pole pallet. So this pallet came by legislation. How did this come about to put this pallet here?
So
what was the format?
So, Councilman, much with the deployment of all of our small cell equipment, it's based on the need of each provider as they've identified it, where they need to, you know, fill the pockets. When we open this up to the providers, as far as doing the pilot itself, they pick the locations themselves.
Okay, so I guess I look at the southern part of a town, Cell Tower. There's a big need. You know, you drive down 20 or 67, you got over 300,000 cars going east, west, north, and south. And Cell is terrible. You know, like Mr. Kleinman said, very difficult, the need. I don't know, AT&T or whoever, I have been talking to them that there's blackout. I mean, there are black spots all through the part of Southern Dallas. is this the pilot that will go back to the providers and says that this is the only pilot? Would it go somewhere else to the Southern Dallas or what?
Once we approve the design, once we see it out in the field and everybody's comfortable with it, then we'll open up this option to use citywide.
Okay. How we look at timelines? So what is the timeline and how do this process proceed to go forward?
So the first polls went in probably here within the last month. We anticipate the rest of them should probably be in next couple months. At that point, what I envision is that we'd come back and brief council and say, hey, look, this is these are all the pilot project locations. Want to make sure that everyone's comfortable with the design that's out there. And then once, if we get that, then we basically open this up, take off the pilot name and just have this as an option to be deployed across the city.
Okay. Especially in the southern part of Dallas is a safety issue, crime, need more lighting. You know, we have been asking over and over again that we need more lighting in the southern part of Dallas. With the small smart pole pilot program, if that will provide more lighting, there is a big help in safety, especially in District 8. I don't speak in District 8. I ask Encore all the time, how much more lighting can we get? Can we get LED lighting? Can we get bright lighting? You know, we still got that dull lighting in part of Southern Dallas, especially in my district. I'm just speaking of District 8. So if we do look at the parts, I understand, do you want to put these smart cells in parts? I have probably, you know, five different rec centers. We got a whole lot of trails coming from UNT all the way down to Singing Hill, to Glendale Park, all the way to Joppy, to all the way to AT&T Trail. No trail needs lighting. You know, I think that's a good ideal of safety that we can put those small cells around our trails because we are building more trails and the trail definitely need lighting and that's a safety and a crime issue also. So I wanted that we can look at that along our trails. I know that we are in a process and putting a trail from UNT Dallas to Singing Hill Rec Center and we just got a grant from the wildlife of $1 million. So that might be the ideal to put those sails down the trail. They are on a high altitude that can support a smart pole pilot program. So definitely look at our trails. I mean, I don't know through other parts of the city now, but especially District 8, if the trail can put cell phone there, cell poles there, and also provide lighting, that's a safety issue that I would definitely would be pushing forward to. Is that something that we can push forward?
Yeah, we can certainly look into that, sir.
Okay, so would that be a pilot that we had to go through the providers to do that? How did we get that on their radar?
Sir, if I may answer, going in line with Mr. Clayton's comments, we would need to gauge the Parks Board's consensus on it as well as the City Council before we do that, because trails are considered part of the parks or part of the recreation facilities that we have.
Yeah, you know, and my question is number one, back to the deal timeline. You know, we are building trails now throughout the city of Dallas, so I'm going to kind of rush because of safety issues, because we do not have lights on most of the trails that we are designing right now. We don't have lights. And we need more lights.
And we can circle back with the Parks Department, so we can start putting that together.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Grayson.
Thank you. Can we go to page 7? Where is that poll?
I can't tell you exactly, ma'am, but as part of the first ones, they were probably somewhere here close to downtown.
So that's an older model. And yes, to Mr. Clayton's concern, because at first I shared it with the width of the new poles, but if you don't have that wider width where everything's contained within it, you get them hanging these boxes on the poles. So I do think the wider pole is preferable. And I wanted to say thank you to you all for coming and briefing me so thoroughly on this and answering all my questions. And I feel a lot more comfortable about it now than I did when you first briefed mobility. So thank you for the more thorough information.
And if I could, I would also like to point out that this poll, it cost the providers somewhere around $4,000 or so to put up this version. The smart poll that we're looking at now costs anywhere from $14,000 to $20,000. So they are making a pretty decent contribution to our community as far as aesthetics and whatnot. So we just wanted to make
It is much better to have it all contained within the pole. It's like the stealth cell towers that look so much better than having all that equipment hanging on the outside of the tower. So I just think it's a big step in the right direction. And if they are spending that kind of money, good, because they're not paying us for the use of our right-of-way. So good for them to have to spend more money on the poles. So thank you.
Yes, Mr. Felder.
Yes. Several of my colleagues have hit on points that are important to me. And can you bring up the diagram with the locations on it for me? Yes. So when I look at that, I don't see anything in District 7. Can you tell me how many of the poles are proposed for District 7?
Of these, there aren't any proposed for District 7. However, there are additional small cell locations across the city.
But, I'm interested in
District 7. I can give you specific locations for District 7.
So, again,
I thought Fair Park was in this.
That was a no. That was
they won't. Yeah, the provider is trying to work with Fair Park on that. But
that's what I thought.
Let me finish my point, please. So that concerns me. You know, you heard one of my colleagues, Mr. Kleiman, talk about him talking to another council member that lives in the southern sector. And you also heard Mr. Atkins refer to calls being dropped in. I have an office in the MLK Center. I can't make a call when I'm inside of the MLK Center on my cell phone. I have to step outside to make a call. We got an issue. We have a problem with equity and equality when it comes down to service. And so I can't support a program that is not going to serve my community and the entire southern sector. We have a problem here. I'm not going to allow the mobile industry to dictate where they're going to put their cell towers if they're not going to be equitable in the southern sector. That's not going to happen. You got a fight on your hands. I'm tired of being last in everything that we do. As staff, I expect you to make sure that every part of the city gets the same treatment. That's not happening. So we have to make sure that these companies understand that you're not going to move forward unless you're going to give equitable and equal treatment throughout the city of Dallas. That's what has to happen here. Why would you bring a diagram like this if you look around this horseshoe and who represents those areas? That's a problem, sir. That's a problem, staff. We have to make sure that the southern part of the district, if we're talking, what about the MVA? You know, we have several council members that have huge progress in their districts, in the southern sector. We need service. We need connectivity. And you cannot allow these companies to think that just because, regardless of whether they spend $4,000 or $14,000, it doesn't matter to me if it's not in my district. It doesn't matter to the constituents that reside there that have had to suffer. Let's think about this. I venture to tell you to say that South Dallas and District 7, we're probably still in 3G, and they're talking about 5G. But AT&T will not sit up there and tell you what they have. It's always a secret. oh, we can't allow you to look at that. We can't. That's proprietary information. Well, guess what? We're going to make sure I'm going to fight. And I hope that my colleagues will fight along with me to make sure that we have equitable treatment, that we have the same thing. We're not going to be two generations behind. This is 5G. South Dallas District 7 has 3G. We want 5G. And I'm asking staff, and I'm direct. Well, I guess I can't direct staff. I'm going to direct the city manager to direct staff to make sure that we get 5G in District 7 and the other parts of the southern sector. If we're going to grow, and the mayor mentioned that, the southern sector, we have to have the technology that goes along with it. We can have jobs, we can have economic development, we can have housing, but we have to have technology to go along with that. Trust me, corporations are looking at the technology, the connectivity, and we're not doing that. So I'd love to hear your response on that.
How about Mr. Broad? Next, wanted to say something.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Councilmember Felder. We're starting out the new year in a great and positive manner. And so one of the things I wanted to say, one, I appreciate you sharing with the team that I think what we're depicting may not reflect the equity that I think you or this entire council would hope to have as we start to roll out or companies start to roll out new technologies. I will tell you this, between myself and staff, as well as the partners that actually provide the poles and or control the technology, we've been talking with them over several months, if not at least the last year and a half, about how they can begin to invest in Southern Dallas, particularly around many of the strategic programmatic changes that I think we're making, not just as staff, but this council's policy. So I think there's been a willingness to do that. And so I think what's incumbent upon us is that we continually work with them to share with them where we plan to develop, where we plan to invest, finding ways to create those pockets and nodes of economic development. And I think we're doing that. And I'd say it's not lost on us that, again, there has been severely neglected areas of technology in the Southern District. I will say even in my own house, short of Wi-Fi, it is tough to get beyond one or two bars. And so I can appreciate that. And again, we're going to work diligently with those providers to do it. But understand, again, we've got to, I say, coax them to try to better understand where those inequities are. And we've got to demonstrate that through data, whether that's the MBA and or other types of zoning and other kinds of things that we're trying to do to improve the Southern District. So I appreciate your passion. I think I share the concerns, particularly of Councilmember Atkins, around lighting and finding ways to amplify lighting, as well as putting technology, I'd argue, in some of our parks and other locations as people tend to not be able to move away from their smartphones. I think we need to give everybody the same types of advantages no matter where they are in this community. And so we'll continue to do that. So I appreciate your passion, and we'll continue to work in that regard and keep council posted on how we move forward with our progress with many of our major cell phone providers.
Thank you. Oh, please.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Mr. McGue, would you jump off and then jump back on? Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Felder.
Wait a minute. You started the clock before I got.
I don't worry.
All right. So to the extent that, you know, I hear what TC is saying and you hear what I'm saying, it's important. Today or yesterday, Spectra started their contract, the public-private partnership at Fair Park. That's a $50 million investment. We don't have the technology to get them where they need to go. So it should be important to you. It should be imperative to the city.
Wait a minute. Thank you.
That we make sure that South Dallas Fair Park, District 7, is up to par with the rest of the city in 5G and not 3G.
Thank you, Mr. Felder. Mr. Kingston.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. As with so many things here at City Hall, we have entered into a Kafka-esque development pattern. I appreciate Mr. Knight's quixotic attempt to stop these rapacious small cell installers from stealing our valuable right-of-way, abetted by people on this council and, frankly, abetted by the entire legislature. I note that we spend hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars on lobbying every year, and I decided to take a look at SB 1004 because I had forgotten this little fact. We got zero votes in the Senate in our favor. We got six in the House. That was a phenomenal deployment of our lobbying dollars there. If anybody's keeping score, I don't know if anybody actually keeps score down there. It's very difficult to grade a lobbyist. So here's the Kafkaesque part. All those sites that you see are sites where these people couldn't afford the fair market value of our right-of-way. Wait. We don't allow this in residential neighborhoods? Is that right?
As of today, yes, sir.
Yeah, so how many people live in that neighborhood where you see all those sites?
I couldn't give you that number, sir.
A total for, if we're going to include that part of Victory and Uptown, you're going to look at approximately 16,000 people live there, more dense than any other neighborhood in the city. Like, you literally couldn't piss off more people with any other location of a small cell antenna. So it's very interesting. The installers said that part of the reason they needed this was to fill in the coverage holes that our Southern Dallas representatives have quite rightly pointed out. My friends, they have no intention of doing that. They went to the legislature specifically to make sure that Mr. Knight couldn't ask them to do that, that they got to put it wherever the hell they wanted it, and they have no intention of filling in holes in Southern Dallas. They're not going to do that. I look forward to the budget amendment or whatever it is that allows us to put more lighting in Southern Dallas. That's something that I think many of us have been calling for a while, and it's something that I think Mr. Broadnax has an idea for bringing forward to us. That's great. We'll be with you on that 100%. This is a situation, though, where we have companies who are requiring the citizens of the city of Dallas to subsidize their business model by not paying fair market value for the use of our real estate. And it doesn't matter if you're Democrat or Republican, whoever you voted for in the Senate last time voted against you on this issue. We have 12,000 people downtown that don't want these, and we got people in the southern sector crying out for them. Like I said, the only way this business model works is if Kafka writes it, or if the legislature writes it to shove it down our throats. And it's very distasteful to me. I mean, there's very little that can be done legally at this point. Although I would say, how many of these have been installed in a sidewalk? It's at least four or five that I've seen.
But these were replacing existing streetlight poles as well.
Don't disagree with that, Mr. Pettis. It's a good point. But has anybody measured on either side of those sidewalk poles?
Yes, sir. For ADA compliant, we have to.
And they're 36 inches on either side?
If it's not, we're not going to allow that.
Well, that one that you showed in front of First Baptist is not ADA compliant. I walked by there the other day. We had, I don't know, 30 hours of argument on this council about where bicycles and scooters go. We had outrage, fake outrage across the city about where bicycles and scooters go. If you try to utilize the pedestrian feature that goes across Continental. Suppose you wanted to walk from Victory in Mr. Medrano's district over to the Felix Losada Gateway in Mr. Narvaez's district. That's a designated pedestrian corridor that we've set up. It even has a pedestrian bridge that we paid a lot of money for. Along Continental, after you go under the highway, what you'll notice is that to the extent there is any sidewalk left, it's completely dominated by utility poles, just like these things are going in non-ADA compliant ways. So this is not griping at staff. Staff did what it could. This is being shoved down our throats by those above us. But it's very distasteful. And the I just think the mismatch between what these people intend to do in terms of taking away valuable right-of-way as opposed to providing services in an equitable manner is should turn our stomachs. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Ms. Arnold.
Excuse me. Thank you. I want to appreciate the comments by Mr. Councilmember Kingston. My notes here were reflecting some of what he said, absent a few of those colorful words, but I did have a concern about the role of the lobbyist and the type of information or who's feeding the information to the lobbyists to these companies. Appreciate the comments by Mr. City Manager, but supporting also Mr. Councilmember Felder's comments regarding what I know historically in the southern sector, we have been deprived and neglected systematically, I believe, for more than 30 years that I can testify to. And so it is going to be incumbent upon us to change the conversation. It's going to be incumbent upon us from the southern sector to keep pushing that and understanding the entire council that our constituents are demanding this equity because they're paying for some of these services, half-baked as some of them may be, and we're still not getting the services, much like we're paying taxes in the city and not being serviced equitably, or we're not being serviced at all. And so when it comes to being included in the digital age, if you will, we remain behind, but I think part of that falls in our laps because we've got to continue to push the button and keep pushing and not give up. Because we cannot continue to move generations, and we're telling our children the same old story, and we're repeating the same old message. We're left out. We've not been included. It has to stop, and it begins with us. And City Manager, I appreciate at least the fact that you're acknowledging that, just know that we'll be coming to you with that conversation. The last piece, I think I want to ask the question on Slide 8, on the cameras. Question would be, how does that feature work in terms of monitoring? Because it obviously is there for a public safety piece.
That part, ma'am, we have not worked out yet. I mean, we're working with we work with our transportation group. It's basically designed this to allow for conduit within the pole that we can utilize. So it'd have to be a combination of probably our transportation group and maybe our police department.
So that would be another job for the police to monitor that's your speculation.
That would be my best guess right now as to who would be monitoring it.
Okay, so what you're telling me as we speak, some of these poles that a pilot would not have the possibility as we speak today of adding the cameras.
No, each of the SPARM poles, yes, would have that.
Today they do?
Yes.
So you could go put a camera. What process would you follow, or procedure or protocol to add a camera? Or a directive? Who would give you a directive to put a camera on one of these smart poles?
Probably our leadership, ma'am. That would be probably between Majid and Mr. Broadnax.
All right, so you're saying Mr. Broadnax would do that? So what would you, I guess Mr. Broadnax, I would ask you that question. What would cause you to put a camera on a specific pole? Would it be the public safety? Would it be the fact that you know, what's going on, illegal dumping? Just tell me, why would you give a directive for a camera?
Well, Madge's point that he would answer the question, but if I was to guess, which I don't like to do, but I would say in those specific issues, we'd probably be working with our public safety area to see if there were crime issues being reported in that area and or dumping. Those are typically when we place cameras. But I think as we're trying to expand our forces through other means and technology. I think any opportunity to deploy a camera, obviously, in a place where there may be large congregations of people, we might want to take a look at whether or not it would help us and assist as it relates to what goes on in our Fusion Center and other places. But if Magid has more to add, feel free.
Just quickly to add, anything that helps us obtain metrics, whether it's traffic volumes, whether it's crime, as TC mentioned, dumping activities, and anything else, that we wanted to use that data to be able to make more informed decisions on things.
So on the cameras, I think the reason I'm looking at that as well, from the cameras that we're using now, I understand that there's a problem with the longevity in terms of the battery being able to sustain long hours of surveillance. So would you know if this is a different type of product that we could depend on long term?
It would be no different from some of the cameras that we utilize at our traffic signals with constant feed of electricity. So I don't think that would be an issue. And there's very modern cameras right now that sustain a lot of storage in it that would be able to do that.
So what's the lifespan right now? You know, when we're doing monitors on illegal dumping, my understanding those cameras, how long, what's the lifespan?
I'd have to get back to you. I don't want to give you the wrong answer.
Could you do that? Because I wanted
to. We could do that.
Yeah, we need to know that. Otherwise, it's not any use of us adding the camera if it can't last more than a week in terms of holding the footage. All right, I appreciate that, but I did want to just underscore that and just know that we've got work to do as it relates to inclusion in this new pioneer age of digital.
Thank you. Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Mayor. Most of my questions have been answered. So it's regarding like kind of what control we have over where the locations, these polls are placed. So if it's a visibility triangle, I mean, if a problem like that, is that tested and a poll can't be put there? Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then they are supposed to be ADA compliant.
That's
correct.
I've
heard today that there are some that aren't, but to your knowledge, they are.
No, we check all of those specs before we approve a permit.
Okay. So we're kind of limited by the bill, though, of where they can be placed outside of those, the ADA, visibility, anything else that we can restrict to location.
Yeah, so residential and also within the parks, within 300 feet of a park.
Is where there is a restriction.
There's a restriction today, yes.
And residential.
Yes.
But then you gave an example that you're looking at putting one in a residential location.
As a pilot, that's correct.
Okay. So we could restrict residential.
We do today. It's restricted today. We knew we eventually wanted to open it up probably to residential areas. And so when AT&T approached us about this and showed us, hey, we're willing to match the poll that is there, we said, okay, we'll move forward with it as a pilot. But we put in the additional steps for permit approval, which is community and resident approval first.
Okay, and we've talked about areas that we want to see, and you potentially said you could look at incentivizing areas. What are your ideas? How is that going to be done? Is that possible?
So one of the things that we've done is that we've discussed is maybe providing a credit. Today, instead of, as I mentioned, the cost of the polls, somewhere around like the typical polls, $4,000 to $5,000, we thought about maybe asking the providers to go in and put those polls in the locations that we want, and we give them a credit. I think it's $1,000 or so. Be about $1,000 or so a year. About $1,000 or so a year that we'd give them a credit for whatever they paid to put that poll in that area. So that way we can incentivize.
So like a monetary incentive then.
That's correct.
Okay. Because we can't require if you put one here, you have to put it in another location. That you can't.
No.
Right, because of the bill. And then last I would just say, you know, I have a very dense area of Hickory Meadow, which we're looking at trying to increase lighting, Wi-Fi, things that we've kind of identified with in the development of the planning of the library. And, you know, so in an area like that, when you're working with any of these providers, you know, be more than happy to, you know, work on a pilot program where we could, you know, incentivize these kind of pools that would provide, you know, that kind of access. But you're talking about just really the access to the small cell, not necessarily a free Wi-Fi.
We've talked about that. Yeah, we've talked about that.
Because I've seen some of these like smart poles that can provide all that, the cameras for security, the lighting, and as well as Wi-Fi. So, but that's we've identified that as, you know, a need in that area with this, especially the lack of access to Wi-Fi and services in the Vickery Meadow. So when we're talking, if there's anybody I could help you talk with or be involved in, let me know.
I appreciate it, ma'am.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. McGew.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm trying not to repeat what other folks have said, but to Ms. Gates' point there at the end, I guess, Mr. Brodnick's my first concern or issue is the empty seat over there I wish was filled with our chief innovation officer. Because she started, I've met her, and I'm excited about that, but this is a discussion, I believe, that should start from that point, start looking at what our city needs are around the free Wi-Fi, around public safety, where the cameras are, and then we try to use that as a guide for bringing in the small cell providers and look at it from the other way around. And so my first ask is that as we continue this discussion, I don't want to get a bunch of polls out that we now back up and say, oh, I wish we would have done this with it, or I wish we should have put it there versus here, or whatever else it is. I hear bits and pieces of it from Madge and Robert, and I appreciate, you know, the thought being there. But if we have the opportunity to look at free public Wi-Fi in certain areas and, you know, a real use of public safety on how we're going to put the cameras in a new way and polls communicating to each other and all this other stuff, I sure hope we're doing it on the front end and not just kind of bowing down and letting this happen as it goes and then saying we're going to, this is all we can do, the state said it and whatever. I hope we're also thinking with terms of innovation in mind. And so I guess my question is, are we, and what else do we need to do to answer some of these questions before we just get it handed to us?
Sir, I want to mention to you that I'm working with the city manager on an LED master plan, a street lighting plan that would include some of the priority areas, and those priority areas will overlap with MVA, would overlap with recap areas, some of the priorities in the southern sectors and other areas.
But
that
but
plan
even,
is
even
still in the
that,
works.
Even as you do those streets, I think it's also parks and trails and the other components you've heard mentioned there that obviously we're thinking about it, but we haven't gone there yet.
We're not there yet. So that's something that we're going to also take a look at as well. Some of that will be all encompassing, including the LED lighting, the Wi-Fi coverage, and possibly some of the proposals that we put out there for the carriers to say this is where we're interested in. You know, the council talked about taking a leadership role, and we're planning on taking that leadership role. We just want to make sure that our LED plan is well vetted first, and so that's something that we're going to be looking at over the next few weeks, hopefully.
Okay, so with one component, the LED plan, and then the trail safety plan, and then the public safety plan, we need somebody coordinating and pulling all these things together so we're not looking in our rearview mirror versus looking forth with forethought. And so are we doing that?
I believe we are. We've had several cross-departmental meetings and discussions, and we can always ensure that people who may have not participated do participate. And to your point about the chief innovation officer, she has not officially started yet. She starts on January 11th, so that's why she is not engaged at that point in this discussion. So we will definitely make sure that she is a part of that team and can provide that type of thought around how we are working towards becoming a smart city and utilizing every opportunity to enhance what we're doing across all data points and areas of interest.
Thank you, Mr. Brodnick.
Thank you. Second round, Mr. Kleiman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'd like to just add a little brief context around Mr. Kingston's very appropriate comments about our lobbying efforts and our failure in the legislature to do anything on this effort. This was clearly a very bipartisan slam against the cities and against local control. Unfortunately, our lobbying efforts, we don't have the ability to write checks, while all these carriers do. And, you know, watching David Tate from AT&T walk into a committee meeting and hand the chair the statute for them to vote on, written by industry, just for that, and everything that Don said and I said and everybody said down there got nowhere because, of course, there was no money behind it. So that's an unfortunate nature of our legislature, and we'll be facing that again here this spring, and I will appreciate all y'all's efforts. I know everybody is really pledged to help us work directly with the legislature. We do have a considerable change in our delegation, and we've been meeting with them, and I'm optimistic that at least we'll get their ear a little more attentively than maybe we have gotten in the past. But on this issue, like I said, it was just a bipartisan effort just to slam local control. It was awful. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins.
Thank you, Mayor. Matt, a great briefing. I guess, Mr. Wonders, can you come forward, please? Going to Mark Clayton question is number one, is had to go through the park department to look at this power program. The question was asked, and Mr. Clayton said, hey, we need to go to the park department. My understanding, he had never been to the park department. Is it scheduled to go to the park department, this briefing, to make a decision on what we're talking about on these pilot program? Have you scheduled that yet, Mr. Winters?
Yes, so we have met
I think your microphone's not on. Is it?
Sorry, there we go. Sorry about that. We have met with city staff. I see this, these towers as an opportunity and a potential amenity in city parks. I have a vision for these towers to be something more than just basic engineering infrastructure, however, and I don't think it would take much to upgrade the aesthetics and appearance of these so that they might incorporate lights, security lights. They might incorporate banners, perhaps, with the name of the park. There might be amenities at the base, water fountain, trash cans, all that blend in with the overall all park aesthetics and the park furnishing packages that we've been implementing around the city.
Well, the reason why I asked that, number one, you know, we had a whole lot of parks at night. They had tennis courts, you know, baseball facility, football facility. This would be another way to have those lighting there at the park, and also be a way for you yourselves there, because there is a amenity there to use for these smart poles. So my deal is, number one, I would look at a timeline, and I guess, Mr. Knight, I guess that Dunn, are you listening? It's two conversations going on. Do I have your attention? Okay, thank you, sir. We said lobbies, going back to lobbies this day, we're talking about parks and recs, and we said the city council got to go to the park department, then got to come back to the city council to get approved to how we look at these lighting, especially with our trails in the park. Is that something they got to go back to the state legislature to talk about this pilot program?
No.
No. Okay. So, Robert, you're going to jump in there. So how do we get this process precision, and what is the timeline?
Councilman, keep in mind that when you speak about lights within the parks and on the trails and whatnot, it's a separate process.
I know. Right. That's what I'm trying to figure it out.
Right. It's a separate process in that, like, it's not – these are not subject, what you're asking
about. I know the part is not subject, but how do we get that on the train?
We have to work with our parks department, sir. And we talked about how we would be moving forward with it, and the partners as well. We'd certainly have to start working on that here in the next. We can start.
Well, I want to ask you to do that. That's what I'm asking.
Yeah,
the request that's easy. And get back with me with a timeline.
Yes, I can.
Thank
do
you.
That.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold.
Yeah, quickly. Thank you. A couple of questions, but to the lobby, Mr. Don. What is your name again?
Don Knight.
Could you answer this question for me? Where do you get, what is your primary job, I guess I want to say, in terms of this, a lobbyist for, on this topic?
Sure. Well, in addition to being an assistant city attorney here and dealing with technology, with regulatory matters involving right-of-way management and franchising and that sort of thing, I'm also chair of an organization called the Texas Coalition of Cities for Utility Issues. And in that role, I'm often at the legislature representing cities on matters such as SB 1004 and other issues such as that.
All right, so my question then becomes, where do you, so if you're with the city, you're getting the information that you're feeding to, that you take to Austin, you're basically getting from staff?
Right, and other cities as well.
Right, but right now I'm just interested in Dallas and the information mm-hmm. that you're taking back to Austin. Is that where you're taking it, or Washington? Where do you go with your?
Yeah, Austin.
All right, so I guess the question is why, how long have you been in this position?
Since 2000.
As a lobbyist?
Well, no, I'm not a lobbyist. I'm just a staff member that testifies, at hearings, and I have participated in stakeholder meetings at the legislature.
All right, so the piece I heard about the information getting to the lobbyist going to the legislative body, you're not taking the information?
Right. That's not my role.
All right. So I wanted to just clarify that because I was trying to figure out where you're getting your information that continues to bring about the lack of results that we're looking for in the southern sector. So
I will say this. It's not a lack of information. Cities have provided plenty of information. It's a lack of desire on the part of the legislature to do what cities need to be done.
All right. So you're saying it from that, but obviously there's a breakdown even from this part, this house, to the house in Austin, because for some reason we're still not getting what we need to get in the southern sector. That's what I'm trying to get to. There's a breakdown somewhere in the communication.
Sure.
And maybe it's a breakdown with the data, so I'll be looking for that data. So question would be this. Who can give me, this is what I need from you, Mr. Magic, of this group. The small cell sites are in District 4. That's number one. I need the cell map, the District 4, based on also the service providers. You may be able to do an overlap. I'm not sure. And then from page 6, I think you have slide 6, of the cell applications for the small cell sites, I would like to know where are those. Are any of those in District 4? Have those requests made in District 4? So what would be the timeline you could give that to me?
We'll get that to you by next Wednesday. Well, it gives a week.
All right. And we can talk quickly offline see if we can kind of speed that up a little bit, because I have a community meeting. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Felder.
Yes. I'd like to ask the question, is our legislative liaison here? No? Okay. All right. So, Don, I guess I'll address you and then Mr. Kleinman as well. I'd like to get a copy of the legislation that was written with regard to this particular issue. I'd like to know how the North Texas delegation voted, the state representatives as well as the state senator. To the extent that I need to know who is operating in the constituents' behalf and who's not. That's very important, because if we have someone that is not supporting the community in which they serve as a legislator, the entire community needs to know that. And so that's the information that I need. Mr. Kleinman, if you will help me to get that information, how they voted. This is very important, because we cannot continue. We need to put a flashlight and every kind of light on these particular legislators that have not supported the community, because this didn't happen by itself. This didn't get to be the way that it is by itself. And it doesn't matter whether if they voted and they're going to lose because they're outnumbered, that's fine. But if you voted with the herd and you betrayed the community, that needs to be exposed. So those are the issues that I'm concerned about. I'd like to get that information. I also like to echo what my colleague Carolyn Arnold asked for. Can you get me the same overlay for District 7? we have to continue to put a chink in the armor and make a change. And I'm not of the mindset that nothing can be changed. Yes, it can.
Well, we'll provide maps of all the districts.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
So the final thing I want to say is that, you know, as we continue down this path, I think many people have gotten comfortable in the way that the status quo, the way that things are. To me, it appears that the technology companies have too much power, and that their hand has reached into the state legislature and even reached into City Hall, and they're determining the outcome of our communities in terms of technology. And we need to put a spotlight on that. We need to find out who they control. That is crucial to the entire city, but specifically the southern sector. And so last thing I want to say is I'm asking the city manager to speak with his staff and make sure that we have equity and equality one more time throughout the city of Dallas, specifically the southern sector. We have to have it. We haven't had it. And so you represent change. I represent change. We have to make sure that we're doing everything we can.
Thank you.
To make sure that this district and the city.
Thank you.
Just a second. I'm finishing up.
Time's up.
Represent. Just one second. That we represent everything that the city needs to be a whole city. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now I'm done.
Thank you. Appreciate this briefing. Obviously, you feel our pain, and this isn't something that's just happened. Okay? I mean, this has been going on in Austin for a long time, and we are going to continue to work on this issue, but it's a uphill fight. It's not only just in the state of Texas. It's throughout this country that there's a real question about how much power cities are being given versus states. And it's a constitutional issue that you can read about in many, many places. And it comes to the forefront when you have something like technology happen. That being said, technology is happening. It's coming. And our job is to, while we want to deal with what is happening at the state, is to harness that for our citizens of Dallas in an equitable manner and in the most productive manner. And that's why it's once again becomes a strategic question for us on how we're going to help guide this technology throughout our city. That is the question we should be asking ourselves. And I think you've got a lot of good input here, but I think it comes back to economic development. It comes back to how we use this infrastructural tool for the things that we need. How do we become a smarter city? How do we become a safer city? I'm so excited that many people in this council and are applauding you, Mr. Al-Ghafri, on lighting in southern Dallas. It's something that I believe will help drive not only safety, but economic development. I've spoken, as you know, to Encore, and they are willing to get on board on this, and this could be a major initiative for us as we guide this technology through the city. So how we take one thing and create what we want to do in other ways, I think, is a good way to approach it. You guys are working. I applaud Mr. McGue's coaching to make sure that we're cross-siloing all this stuff, that we're bringing one plan that encompasses a lot of stuff as opposed to just certain technologies. I think that's the right way to do it. Congratulations, Council. We're done. 12:38. Meeting's adjourned.